The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 145. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 145, introduced by Representative Simpson, an act relating to administration of government regarding professional and commercial license lawful residences. Residents, your committee, this bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which returned it with a recommendation amended. Ayes, Brown, Illaway, Martin, Meyer, Miller, Korberg, Stepson, Zwanitzer, Dan, No, Gilmore. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Illaway, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 145 do pass. And I further recommend the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Rather than for me to try and ask for the question on this, I think I'd rather have the Standing Committee Amendment briefly discussed by the bill sponsor, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, members of the House, House Appropriations Committee is continuing to work a few bills, so that's why some people are off the floor. House Bill 145 and Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, the bill itself is professional and commercial licenses, lawful residence, requiring that anyone who would receive a state or local public benefit that's defined on page 3, line 16 of the bill, would need to produce secure and verifiable documents as defined on page 2, line 12 of the bill. When I initially had the bill drafted, driver's licenses or similar documents issued for the purpose of identification by a state, if it contains a photograph of the individual or other personal identifying information, was in the bill. I then learned that the federal agency that handles immigration issues has indicated that state driver's licenses are not adequate means of proof of citizenship, and primarily that is because there are some states that issue driver's licenses without requiring the person to prove citizenship first. And but then looking at this bill further and the impact that it could have, I think it's fair for Wyoming purposes to allow employers to ask for a driver's license or to accept a driver's license as a means of identification. So I added that back in or asked the Corporations Committee to do that, and that's what the Standing Committee Amendment does. And also as one of the elements of the secure and verifiable documentation, you'll see on page 2, line 21, that includes a resident alien card, alien registration card, or other document, if the document, and then over to page 3, contains a photograph of the individual and such other personal identifying information. We were informed in committee that those resident alien cards do not have photographs on them, and that sometimes those cards take a long time to receive. So, and the federal government does not require a photograph on that card, so that's why the Standing Committee Amendment wipes out that requirement that the resident alien card or alien registration card require a photograph. And that's the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? The Standing Committee Amendment number, question having been called, all those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 145, which goes right into that Standing Committee Amendment and adds a sentence on the end that says that the driver's license or similar document shall be current or expired less than 1 year. There was really no definition in there as to, could you take in a 5-year-old expired driver's license that would be proof. There needs to be some definition, so that's what that would be. And I would move the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 unless there are objections.
All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 has passed.
Mr. Chairman, back on the bill. You'll see here that I explained to you briefly what the bill does. I would also like to point out to you that an applicant for any state or local public benefit needs to prove their identity with the secure and verifiable documentation as it's defined. And state or local public benefit is defined. And that includes grants, contract, loans. This is page 3, line 16. Professional license or commercial license in any retirement, welfare, health, disability, public or assisted housing, post-secondary education, food assistance, unemployment benefit, or other similar benefit. Now, the last page of the bill, page 7, goes into the workers' compensation statutes and amends what is required for an employer to receive from an employee to, you know, feel comfortable that they're hiring a someone who is not illegal. And it strikes the word documentation, which is extremely broad, and then makes it consistent with the definition of secure and verifiable documents on page 2 of the bill. So that is, you know, any document issued by a state or federal jurisdiction or recognized by the U.S. government and that is verifiable by federal or state law enforcement, intelligence, or Homeland Security agency, including U.S. passport, resident alien registration, and then Social Security cards and driver's licenses as amended. And I believe that's a good change to the bill. There are some benefits that anyone can receive, whether they're illegal or not, and those are defined on page 4 of the bill. And those are really health and safety issues that a federal law, for one, prohibits someone from not providing, and instances where you would want to immunize people under subparagraph C on page 4. You want to treat emergency medical conditions and those types of things. But Colorado, our neighbor to the south, passed a similar law in 2006, and it became effective on January 1 of 2007. I feel that this is an appropriate way to administer these public benefit programs, and I'd stand for any questions.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? All right. The question having been... Representative Floyd Escobel.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. First of all, I was wondering if any of these provisions were already covered by federal law, and the sponsor did go into that to some extent, but a little bit more explanation on that. But the other question is kind of a hypothetical, but assuming that an individual not lawfully in the United States is employed in an extra-hazardous occupation, and that individual is seriously injured, or is killed, for that matter, through no fault of his or her own. For example, let's say a mine explosion, and the individual is killed. I was wondering what, if any, benefits that person might be eligible for, if any. And I guess the third one, is if the person is not eligible for anything because of a mine explosion, the person is killed, does that grant immunity to the employer so that the employer who might have not have had some safety, possibly might not have had some safety measures in place, would be immune from any type of action? Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, in response to the first question about which provisions are covered by federal law, I don't know the answer to that. I do believe it's most of the provisions related to those things that states cannot restrict access to on page 4 of the bill. Otherwise, I believe states have the ability to do a great deal of things to require legal status to obtain the benefits. On the hypothetical about workers' compensation benefits, that's somewhat of a complicated answer to that question. If the employer reasonably believed that the documentation they were provided was valid and hired the person and they were paying premiums on them, even if they were illegal, they would be covered. And they have been covered in Wyoming in the past. If the employer knew that that was not the case, that they were hiring an illegal and they were paying premiums and the person was covered, I still think they would have an argument of coverage. If the person was hired, was illegal, and the employer did not pay premiums but had insurance coverage, there would be some potential benefits for that person. But if the person who's hired is known to be illegal, there's no workers' compensation premium, and there's no insurance, there won't be any coverage, but they could sue the employer civilly. And then, you know, whatever might be the circumstance there with the employer. So that's not an easy answer and depends oftentimes on the circumstances of the case. And I'll check into that further and maybe provide a more full answer to the intent of the question, which I think was probably, you know, if the employer knowingly hired an illegal and that person was injured or killed, would they receive benefits? And I still think it depends on the circumstances, but I'll get a better answer for you.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I like this piece of legislation because it leads into what we've been trying to do in the last couple of years. But what happens if the employee has the documents and they all appear to be legal, and then it really turns out that the documents are fakes or what he has is documents that he bought and they're not good documents. What really happens there?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader?
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask if there are any more questions to have them pose now. Otherwise, I don't know the answer to that, and I'll have to research that.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 145 do pass, please signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. House Bill 145 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 173. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 173, introduced by Representative Harshman, an act relating to aggravated assault and battery penalties. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned it with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Alden, Begbie, Buchanan, Gingrey, Mercer, Olson, Throne. No, Dockstetter, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Buchanan, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 173 do pass, and further move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 173. Ladies and gentlemen, the Standing Committee Amendment basically deletes a mandatory minimum sentence that was included in this legislation. There was a 10-year minimum. We took that out, so now it just reads on the second page that it's a felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 20 years. And if there are no questions, I'd call for the question.
All right. You've heard the motion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Standing Committee Number 1 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to the good representative from House District 37 for an explanation of the bill.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, good Chairman of Judiciary. This, as you remember, folks, it passed the House on introduction 59-1, dealing with one part of the aggravated assault and battery penalties, particularly under the subparagraph 1 that causes serious bodily injury to another intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. We had lots of testimony in Judiciary, very sad situations, and, you know, if we want to debate and talk some more about this, but the district attorney here in this town testified he would like that flexibility. There's just some things that are so heinous, but they're not quite under attempted homicide, or so we need to have this as some flexibility for our prosecutors and our judges. So with that, I'd call for the question unless there's further discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 173 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 173 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 102.
House Bill 102, introduced by Representative Landon, an act relating to quality child care. This act was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which returned it with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yeagy, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey, you've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a recommendation that House Bill Number 102 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would explain the Standing Committee Amendment, or, well, why don't I just give it to the good sponsor from Sheridan, because he was in agreement with it. It might be easier.
Representative Landon, or Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think I'll explain the amendment after the bill, after talking about the bill a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, what this bill is following up on is some legislation that we passed a year or so ago in which we were trying to improve the quality of child care services for children. And we thought one of the ways to do that was to improve the education level of providers. And so we wanted to help encourage providers to get more education in early childhood through two methods. One of them was to enable them to go back to school for an associate's degree or even a four-year degree. And the second one was to avail themselves of some grants to travel to seminars and or special type of events where there was education activities going on. When we wrote that legislation, we also included a provision that if they availed themselves of it and did not perform or did not go, did not pass their classes, we expected them to pay all the money back. And that turned out to be the problem, to pay all the money back. Instead of so if they had been attending a school for a year or two and then during one semester they left and didn't complete that semester, they would have to pay back the money for the entire time they went to school. A disincentive to take advantage of the program that came up while they were writing rules and regulations. So consequently, Mr. Chairman, this particular bill was targeted to address that if they do not complete a semester, they will pay back that semester instead of the entire payments. You'll see that the scholarships are addressed on page 1 at the bottom, and once again on page 2, both of those being in little A. And then on little B, if they breach the contract, then you can see that on line 12, they repay that portion of the funds for the developments that they accrued during that semester. We further on little C did the same thing for the grant programs where they get a grant to go to a single type event or a week-long event that's not necessarily for credit but can be for some kind of licensing. We did not have quite the right language in there, so we asked that it be amended in committee, and that's what the standing committee amendment was. We were calling on page 2, line 5, where it says written agreement. We wanted that to be a contract, so we added, instead of agreement, we specified that as being a contract. Same on page 2, line 15, and then conforming language by adding in little I that you see where it strikes agreement and inserts contract. Unless there's any questions on the standing committee amendment, I'd ask for a question on that at this time.
You've heard the motion on standing committee amendment number 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee number 1, House Bill 102, has passed committee of the whole.
Mr. Chairman, final explanation, little C and little E have to do with the grants that like I said, are for short-term educational opportunities, not for degrees, and we wanted that to read the same, that if they did not complete those classes or seminars that they were being paid to attend, that they would pay the money back. And I think with that'll pretty well explain the bill. But I stand for any questions.
Representative Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need a clarification here. Some of us in the House had some real concerns about this bill, and part of the concerns that we had a couple years ago was when we got into developing these educational grants, is the concern that people could go. I think there's funds available for like 8 semesters, and they could complete 7 semesters, fall out of the program and get their tuition paid, fall out of the program for half a semester, and then only have to pay back that semester, go on and get another 2 semesters and go teach, you know, in the public schools or someplace and not be in this program at all. So if that's what this bill is doing, I guess I'm pretty cautious about us. I think we're going to lose the intent of the program. And if people want to get involved in these grant scholarships, that's great. But they need to know when they go in that they better stay in, or the consequences will be more than just losing, you know, 1 semester of the benefit. So if you can answer that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think that's certainly the goal, is that I think that, you know, I can't speak for every individual, and every individual is going to be different. But as I recall in this proposal, a lot of them are going to continue to work in the facilities that they're working in. And whether they complete a certain number of classes and then drop out is really difficult for us to is for us to know. And why did they drop out? You know, did they start a family? Is there, you know, we just can't know all those things that can happen to an individual that might very well sidetrack their plan to complete the program. But I think that any education, any gains that they make, any new ideas, any new strategies is going to help that person as a person and going to help the services they provide. So I don't think that this is going to be something that encourages them to drop out. I don't think this is an incentive to drop out. And I think that it to require that they pay back all of the fees if some circumstance doesn't allow them to complete it is really a pretty onerous requirement.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. During the testimony during the committee, we asked who receives these funds, and we were informed that the funds don't really go to the student. They go to the whatever institution it is that he is attending. So they can't go willy-nilly spend this money and then just drop out. The funds are still held. The only funds that this refers to, I believe, and Chairman Lannan can correct, or the good gentleman from Sheridan can correct me, is that they wouldn't have to pay back are those funds that were used while they were attending the institution.
Is there further discussion on the bill? Representative Goggles.
Mr. Chairman, speaking on and for the bill, in our testimony as well, this is clarifying language. Not all of our efforts are going to result in 100%. And you take the statistical bell curve, 60% of us fall in that bell curve. Obviously, you're going to have some outliers. This language is to help us determine those outliers that may complete 7 semesters, endure a hardship, and then come back and complete that last semester. So this is language to clarify the intent of the program. On the floor of the bill.
Any other discussion? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with recommendation that House Bill number 102 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 102 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 113. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 113, introduced by Representative McComey, an act relating to school finance, minimum teacher resources. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White, signed Representative McComey, Chairman. The bill was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Jones, Peterson, Philp, Warren, excused, Berger, Harshman, Jorgensen.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman McComey, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 113 do pass. And I will pass the explanation of the bill to the shiny-headed gentleman from House District 54. Apparently nobody's paying any attention.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill is a bill that came about when the law executing the teacher minimum resources as adopted in the 2006 law was not clear to the school districts on the application of the enhanced minimum teacher resources, which was adopted by the legislature above the levels recommended by the consultants, and the distinction between the teacher and non-teacher resources. The Department of Education administered the law as intended by the legislature and incorporated by the consultants into the model spreadsheets. The bill clarifies the intent and provides payments to school districts and grandfathers their understanding of the application of the minimum resources prior to July 1, 2001, after which time the payments will be based upon the model as clarified by this bill. The intent was to provide minimum resources only to teachers for the combination of grade levels addressed by the model and not to expand the minimums at each grade band to non-teacher resources. However, reading the way that the bill was worded, that is not what occurred, and legislative intent was not clear in the bill. So I bring you this bill, and the language that's the only language change in the bill is on page 4, where it talks about grades K7, K8, K9, or for K5, otherwise small schools. This is in the small school section. Page 6, excuse me. And this language clarifies the legislative intent now, and from the point forward, these non-teacher resources that are being paid for prior to this time of the adoption of this bill will no longer be paid. On the back of the bill, you can see where the money comes from that was generated, the $3.14 million. Where it goes, there's some large school districts there, but they have a lot of small schools. And that's where this money is going to be distributed, to those small schools in those districts and some of these small districts. And I stand for questions.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With all the respect in the world for my chairman, I just want to air a little bit of my concern about this legislation, as I did in committee. We've had several bills come to our committee that essentially were recalibration bills, and essentially this is a recalibration bill. We only seem to want to recalibrate if it is to the advantage of the school districts. And all the other pieces of legislation that we've brought that were fair, that were reasonable, that had to do with recalibration, took money away from the districts, or there was a disadvantage to the districts, even though it was correct. And we failed those unanimously. This gives more money to the districts. Right or wrong, it's recalibration. This is not a recalibration year. And it's just been something that I've been struggling with. There's no consistency in what we're doing. And that's my internal struggle. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe many in this body share that same concern. However, from this point on, this will take resources away and go back to the way the model was intended to be. We are actually holding these districts whole. This body has the opportunity to say, no, we're not going to do that, but I would recommend you don't do that, because the language is such that we could wind up, again, in discussions, administrative proceedings, hearings, etc., which would probably cost us as much as this is. This money comes from the school foundation program. I'll stand for any more questions.
Are you ready for the question? The question being called, all those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill number 113 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 113 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 77. Sorry, the reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 77, introduced by Representative White, an act relating to education, tuition, dependents of disabled firefighters and EMTs. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman McComey, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 77 do pass. And House, I will turn this over to the fine gentleman from across the mountain who braves the summit more than I'd be willing to do.
Representative White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring to you House Bill 77, Tuition for Dependents of Disabled Firefighters and EMTs. This legislation provides payment for the dependents of disabled firefighters and EMTs who have been disabled in a line-of-duty incident. The passage of this bill would make available the payment of tuition and fees for eligible individuals to attend the University of Wyoming or one of the state's community colleges for up to 10 semesters. The tuition and fees will be paid through the block grant of the institution involved and not impact the state's general budget. The bill covers paid or volunteer firefighters and emergency med techs who suffer a qualifying disability while acting in the scope of their duties. I think we need to recognize the firefighters, EMTs, and other first responders who are on the front lines in potentially dangerous situations and careers. And they're the folks out there that are working on the slick, ice-covered roads, fighting fires, helping the injured in disaster situations. And they're willing to go the extra mile and put themselves in that situation. So I ask for your support in this particular legislation. Law enforcement is already covered with this provision, and the line of duty death is also covered currently for these first responders, the firefighters and the EMTs. If we go through the bill, the basic wording changes on page 2. Basically adds the description of the disabled person, and then on page 3 it mentions qualifying disability after death, deceased or disabled person. Page 4, line 15 through 24, and then the top of page 5 actually is where the biggest wording changes are, and all those are is Romanet 2 and 3, which give the description of the firefighters and emergency med techs that would be covered under this. That's basically the bill. The fiscal note, it was undeterminable because there was a very small number of first responders that this would involve and has involved in the past. So I would ask for your favorable consideration, and I will stand for any questions if there are any.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my opinion, this is just another bill that's kind of one of those feel-good bills where we've arbitrarily taken a cross-section out of our society and selected them to be a recipient of a special benefit that really isn't funded anywhere. It just ends up being a shortfall to the university's systems and we don't know what this fiscal impact is going to be. We don't know who pays it. There's nothing in the bill that says anything about how it interfaces with the Hathaway scholarship. In other words, can they get this benefit and the Hathaway both? I don't know. I just would urge the body to, you know, resist these feel-good type bills and realize that there's probably other cross-sections of society within our state that is equally deserving of this kind of thing, and really that's why we have the Hathaway, where it's available to anybody across all of society. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It may be a feel-good thing, but I would simply pose this question. These people, by definition in the bill, are disabled in the line of duty. Who can better stand the cost for someone who's injured when they're performing a function that's beneficial to society? Who better can stand it? All of us sharing that cost, or do we let all that cost fall on that individual? And is that all the thanks that individual gets? A lot of these people are volunteers. They're not getting anything. And their unfortunate circumstance is our gain. And I think the least we can do as the party most able to bear the burden is bear that burden and take care of the dependents. So on for the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Representative White?
Mr. Chairman, I would just say I do feel good about this legislation, and I'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Are we ready for the question? The question having been called, all those in favor of Representative McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill number 77 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 77 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 118. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 118, introduced by Representative Hallinan, an act relating to civil actions, loss of chance doctrine abrogated. This bill was referred to Committee No. 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which returned it with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Hallinan, Harvey, Eichel, Landon, Lubno, Millen, Stewart, Escobel, K., Hales. No, I'm sorry. Noes, Escobel, K., Hales. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Landon, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 118 do pass. There is no standing committee amendment, and I would like to yield the floor to the good doctor from Campbell County for an explanation of the bill.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Chairman Landon. Well, like everybody else says, this is a simple little bill. So I guess what I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, is to explain House Bill 118, and then after that address the Committee of the Whole amendments that I have prepared for it, as they will really change some of the direction of the bill. And I think it would be material to do it in that manner. If we look at the bill initially, we'll see, like I say, it's very simple. It's two pages. It only changes the entire way of life that we live in those two pages, but it is a simple bill. The thing that it does, it abrogates the decision in the McMacken case, which happened in 2003, and permitted a new doctrine into our code, legal code. I guess I'd call it a new one, at least insofar as the Supreme Court is concerned, called the loss of chance. This bill would abrogate that decision, and abrogate means repeal. I guess the best thing to do to describe this bill would be to go through what the McMacken case was. I had to make out another copy of my simple but ingenious little diagram that shows how the McMacken case affects the lawsuit issue in terms of medical cases. So, the patient HB was a resident of a nursing home, which is part of Johnson County Health Care Center. On the night of March 7, 1999, she suffered what appears to have been a stroke, though there is some disagreement about that. The nurse monitored her through the night, but called the physician at 0430. March 8, the following day, 4:30. A colleague of that physician saw her and at 9 o'clock and then transferred her to another physician. She later died of complications of stroke on March 22, 1999, about 15 days after. Her daughter claimed wrongful death and sued the nurses, doctors, and Johnson County Health Center. The district court ruled that plaintiff, quote, has failed to show that any treatment would have altered the outcome for HB, unquote. And furthermore found that, quote, the plaintiff has failed to present competent evidence that any treatment would, more likely than not, have prevented the hemorrhagic stroke or made a difference in Mrs. B's prognosis or outcome. He thus ruled by summary judgment for the defendants. The daughter appealed to the Wyoming Supreme Court. Now to the loss of chance doctrine and the Supreme Court's ruling and traditional liability law in regard to medical practice. If you look at that simple diagram, an accepted standard of care is necessary to prove liability. The breach of that standard by a preponderance of evidence greater than 50% probability. Causation by that breach of the damage alleged by the preponderance also of evidence greater than 50% probability. To discuss that very briefly also, expert testimony is used to establish the standard of care. In this case, a family physician was expert for the plaintiff, not a neurologist. You would expect a neurologist. This somewhat indicates the fuzziness of the standard of care doctrine itself, or the standard of care element of it. The alleged breach was the delay in obtaining the treatment that the expert family physician thought may have been the cause of the later fatal consequences. She posited that, quote, it was possible that more aggressive action immediately following the discovery that B had suffered a stroke could have ameliorated B's condition. This gets us to the complicated part of the subject, and it is subject to misunderstanding. This was brought up even the other day and when I presented this for introduction. The district court ruled that B's condition immediately after the event of the stroke was so bad that the probability that the alleged breach caused her demise was so low that he ruled by summary judgment for the defendant. The Supreme Court reversed the decision saying that even a small, quote, loss of chance, this new doctrine on the Supreme Court, may have occurred and thus trial is necessary. I'm going to give you a few of the problems I think that this case represents and this doctrine represents. And then I'm going to have my Committee of the Whole amendment, which I think will address it in a way that I think will be satisfactory, hopefully, to a majority of you. One of the problems with the loss of chance doctrine is the encouragement of litigation and the proliferation of weak cases, such as this one, that add to the cost of malpractice insurance, which in turn reduces the availability of medical services and increases its cost. Second, the tendency for the loss of chance doctrine to allow plaintiffs to proceed to trial on the basis of mere conjecture and wishful speculation. If you refer back, at least in my words, it was possible that more aggressive action immediately following blah, 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 could have ameliorated. Those are words of wishful thinking in my belief and also conjecture. A third issue that seldom is discussed is that physicians will be discouraged from taking on the hard cases. Patients with multiple medical problems react much like the proverbial camel and the straw that broke the camel's back. Perfectly innocent, seemingly innocuous medical treatment can have unpredictable, even fatal consequences in people with multiple disease. This has serious implications here in Wyoming. Oftentimes, we will make a diagnosis of a serious condition and refer the patient to a specialist out of state or in a larger community. And they come home to have their complications treated by the primary care physician, such as myself. Our liability in these cases is especially high since the loss of chance ruling. I will have to say that Wyoming patients and their families usually are very understanding, however. I'll go on to just one more little thing, and then I'll discuss the Committee of the Whole amendment. Finally, a few comments on certainty, and I think this is an important issue in regard to this matter. Medical science is not an exact science. and for the law to demand that it be judged as if it is, brings injustice to physicians and fosters a myth destructive to our society. Speculating about small differences in, or small deviations or differences in the chance of survival, a few percent here, a few percent there, is about as accurate as a flip of a coin. But then we had testimony, and I listened, and I discussed this with colleagues in other professions, honorable professions, the legal profession. And so I came up with a few amendments to try to address those concerns. And if I may, I'll present them now, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and proceed.
The first is House Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. That was my first approximation, and I hereby withdraw that amendment. If I may.
Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 is withdrawn.
The second is Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2, and that one is the one that I would like to present to the group here today. That one takes out some of the verbiage that probably is unnecessary and might be a little bit of offensive to our distinguished Supreme Court. We have to be very careful how we say things, and so that's deleted. The second part is a recalibration, and I would have you look on page 2, line 7. And it would delete therefore, and there, after abrogated, it would assert, for any patient unable to establish a loss of chance of 25% or more in a civil action resulting in a successful loss of chance claim, the damages recoverable by the plaintiff shall equal the total sum of the damages for the underlying injury or death multiplied by the percentage of the chance for successful treatment that was determined to have been lost as a result of the negligence of the defendant. The reason for this is those cases, and there are some, where there is not a preponderance of evidence that this person would live or have a successful treatment. In those cases, without some consideration of the loss of chance, those people would have no recovery, even if the doctor did make a commit negligence. This amendment, I believe, addresses that significantly and enough that they will, those people who really have suffered, that had a very good chance, or at least a fairly good chance of survival or successful treatment, they will be able to achieve and be made whole, at least insofar as our system allows. So that's on the one side. That there is a reason for doing it this way. Statistically, physicians do not have an exact percentage of predicting how much your chance of successful treatment is. It's an approximation. That 25% at the bottom, the 25% that will be required for the loss of chance to be kicked in, that 25% approximates the imprecision of our medical science. This is all based on probability theory. There's a couple items you should remember when you consider this. Sensitivity of a test is one, a test that brings in all of the possible positive results. Specificity is all the ones that are positive. If we have a 1% standard, as is reflected in the McMacken case, we bring in a lot of frivolous cases because you cannot prove as a physician that this other treatment may have been a little better. And there's always an expert that is going to be saying, well, maybe he should have done it this way, or maybe he should have done it that way. So this encourages frivolous cases. With the standard set at 51% like it used to be, the specificity is set so high that we will miss some people who actually were damaged by their physician and had a pretty good chance of survival or successful treatment. So this lowers that requirement down to 25%. That is the lowest of any group in our society. That is the lowest percentage of probability that any other group has to face, lower than any other group. The rest of our society is on the 51%. So I think this addresses that group in our society that is injured by a physician. I think it gives physicians the opportunity to practice medicine with a much lower likelihood of having to face frivolous lawsuits. And I would say this. I saw a note from one came from the gallery, and it said, well, isn't that what malpractice is for? I mean, even if you are not guilty, isn't it good that this money is made available to injured people? Well, I guess it is, but on the other hand, I still would like to think that if a court's going to tell me that I did something wrong that killed somebody, that I was really guilty of that. Physicians don't really just think of this as money. It's also an important part of our feelings about ourselves. So I commend this to you, and I would hope that I would move the approval of the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2. And I request your favorable consideration of it. Thank you.
Representative Millen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've spent a lot of time on this and heard a lot from the good doctor from Campbell County. And I just stand in support of this amendment and the bill. Thank you.
Representative Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, speak on in favor of the amendment and the bill. I can't speak exactly to the amendment and the bill, but in general, I think many are like me. When you need a good doctor and you have a life-threatening situation, you want him or her to be there. And when you need a good lawyer, it involves, like the good lawyer from Cody to represent you for fraudulent misrepresentation, you want them to be there. I believe this amendment represents that middle ground that we can all get along. Honor for the amendment.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
This is a monumental day in the history of this legislature. The Wyoming Medical Society and the trial lawyers both agreed on this amendment. Vote before it vanishes.
Okay, we are on Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 2. All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 118 has passed. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with recommendation that House Bill number 118 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 118 has passed, Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 132. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 132, introduced by Representative Jorgensen, an act relating to professions and occupations regarding surveys and engineers. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do be approved. Ayes, Edmonds, Escobel F., Hammonds, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Korberg, Stewart, no, Brechtel, signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Lockhart, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Bill number 132 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I'd like to turn the working of the bill over to the good legislator from House District 16, but point out that I needed to bring in an engineer from Iowa and one from Utah to make sure it got out of the Minerals Committee.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to present this bill, House Bill 132. This was, it's a thick bill, but you saw it last year. And it was last year number 277, I believe. And what happened last year has been incorporated in this bill. The bill last year got through the House, through the Senate up till second reading, and then ended, stopped. What this proposal does is outlined, and I'm sorry this was given to you several days ago, but I did pass out two sheets of paper that had House Bill 132 at the top, engineers and surveyors in fairly bold print. Second page was a letter from the licensing board. And let me just run down it pretty briefly. Let me urge you, if you have any questions, if you have questions from constituents about this issue, please contact me as this bill goes further through the process, because I think we've addressed the issues. What this does is modify and update the statute that supports this board, which was established in 1907. It does deal with the educational requirement, which I'll come back to, which is really the only remaining point that has still been brought up to me by some folks. It improves the ability of engineers and land surveyors to have reciprocity between states. The board is expanded to provide better representation for land surveyors, and it updates disciplinary and penalties in accordance with the AG's recommendations. Last year, there were questions about appropriations which appeared in the bill. This is entirely self-supported by licensing fees. Last year, there was an objection to the date on which the two-year educational preparation would no longer be permissible. The number, the year varied between 2013, 2015, and 2017. This bill has the date 2015 as the time when that two-year educational access would expire. After that time, if someone had that two-year educational background, they still had 4 years to get their experience beyond it. And that is the big issue, the educational one, which I will return to. This is important for a couple of reasons. One, the practice of land surveying has changed since I learned how to do it. I had education in that and an engineering degree. Those courses are no longer given in engineering. It transitioned over the last 40 or 50 years from an apprentice-based profession to a profession that previously was just included in engineering. The trend for state requirements across the country is towards a four-year degree only. We now have one neighboring state, that's Idaho, whose law will change in 2010 to only license folks with a four-year educational background. The other states will follow suit. I have no idea when, but I would suspect that it would be within 10 years. Our current two-year educational access route was established in 1991, or was effective in 1991 when this last statute was amended, because there was a program at LCCC. That program ceased 3 or 4 years ago for lack of students. I believe they had three in the last class. There are two accredited four-year programs, nationally accredited programs in neighboring states, one in Pocatello at Idaho State, one in Denver at Metro State. The tuition at those can be handled through the WICHE program. It is not a hardship for a Wyoming resident to obtain the necessary educational background, which will be the minimum in 2015. So I ask for your approval of this bill so that we might move forward and urge you to contact me if you have any questions about an element within the bill. I'll take questions and would be glad to talk to you later if you have other questions. Thank you.
We do have a Committee of the Whole amendment. Representative Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 132. Ladies and gentlemen, what this does is good representative from Teton County explained in the explaining the bill how one of the things that's going to be phased out is going to be the two-year degree. I don't want this to sound like a turf war, but I'll give you the straight scoop on that. And there is currently a two-year degree in Sheridan College, and it serves quite a number of students in there, and they've been ramping it up and. It's one that, in fact, they'd like to extend around the state to make available in other places. The two-year degree, in order to be able to sit for one of these examinations, it still requires 4 years of field experience or combined office and field experience in land surveying, even after the two-year degree. And I just have a feeling, and I have the assurance and the strong opinion of those who are teaching this two-year certificate type AA degree in Sheridan that they are fulfilling their requirements and training surveyors for the state, and they feel like without this that they won't be able to supply the numbers. You know, they question why the four-year degree. Certainly, they can see the value if it's in engineering, but in little Romanet 3, it doesn't need to be in engineering. It can be in any field, not even directly related, and there's no requirements to have this field experience or office experience. So they felt that the program that they have prepares people and qualifies people to do this, and they didn't think that the hurdle of a four-year degree was significant enough to eliminate what they've been doing to this point, and so they ask that we eliminate, and that's what the amendment does, is eliminates the repealer on page 21, or it repeals the paragraph where these two-year degrees will no longer qualify to sit for this after 2015.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to thank the bringer of the amendment because it certainly focuses the issue. We had a lot of issues last year, and we're down to one. It's most interesting to me that last year the responses to this requirement were between three different dates. Now the response is a two-year education is sufficient. That's a big difference. Whenever you change these kinds of things to keep up with a profession, you have to have a transition. We've had since 1991 to transition this and allow anyone, almost anyone born in 1991, to commit to pursuing this through the through an education-based requirement. So I don't think that's – I appreciate focusing the issue, but I think the argument has changed, and that's why I would encourage any of you with questions to discuss it further with me. As to the any four-year degree, any four-year degree that's the alternative, and the reason for that is that it has to have certain coursework within that degree, which is specified either within or added to, and the 4 years of experience following the degree. Any of these licensing items have educational experience and examination requirements. And the most reliable of those three requirements is education. The most reliable of the education requirements is an accredited program. We have accredited programs in neighboring states. We do not have accredited programs in Wyoming. In my opinion, we will not. I'm on the accreditation commission for these programs and some engineering programs, and I visited five of them in the last 5 years. So I have some sense of what it takes. And it is beyond our ability to generate sufficient students to support in one of our state institutions a viable program in this profession. A 4-year degree for this profession includes calculus through a full second year of calculus and a strong physical science preparation. In a 2-year degree, you would be lucky to get to a pre-calculus algebra course. And it is a difference. It's a question of this state keeping up. Anyone we license in this state with a 2-year degree is not eligible to work in another state which has the 4-year degree as the minimum, and that is becoming the trend. So I urge you to defeat the amendment and pass the bill on. Please come to me with any questions you might have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I will just end in saying that I think that the thing that gives me comfort and should give the body comfort is no matter where you go to school, no matter what your qualifications or experience, you have to be admitted to an 8-hour written examination on the fundamentals of surveying. That should be the hurdle that you have to jump over. That should be the qualifier, not the number of years that you attend a university or the number of years that you can attain a shorter degree that's lesser than a 4-year degree. If you can meet those standards, more power to you, and I think that should be the standard that we hold our surveyors up to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to respond to that last statement as an argument. I guess it was presented as an argument to approve the amendment. I have a graph, a colored graph, which I'll share with any of you, which indicates the history of that fundamentals of surveying exam since October of 2000. I've worked on that exam personally twice a year since 1988. And it's been through several changes. It's a psychometrically defensible examination. This indicates the pass rates for folks with different educational backgrounds. A couple of those are a 2-year degree, and another one is a 4-year degree. And let me just draw the conclusion, and you're welcome to look at it. Those with a 2-year degree average a 45% pass rate, and those with a 4-year degree average a pass rate over 70%. That is a significant basis for the validity of the exam, and it ties right in with why should we license someone to practice a profession they cannot transfer to another situation they may be in by their employer shifting them or their spouse deciding they've had enough. So I urge you to defeat the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking on and against the proposed amendment, and I had to leave the floor for a minute, so I hope this hadn't been, I'm not saying something that had been covered before. The sophistication of surveying has changed so much in the generations from the time we used to take survey instruments on sunny afternoons at the University of Wyoming to see the pretty girls to where it is today with all of the electronics and the GPS and that sort of thing. And the licensure and the importance of those kinds of training has risen to a different level. And I would encourage that we stay with the bill as drafted after much rigor by the certified land surveyors and the state engineers to get a bill that will help our employees in these fields be more marketable anywhere they go. So I encourage the defeat of the proposed amendment.
We are on Committee of the Whole Amendment number one. Are you ready for the question? Oh, okay. The question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number one signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Committee of the Whole Amendment number one has failed. We're back on the bill. Representative Jorgensen.
I have nothing to add.
And the question being called. Oh. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for the bringer of the bill. In reading through these definitions, the practice of engineering and the practice of land surveying, it seems like the definition is so broad. For instance, practice of engineering, it shall embrace such services or work in connection with utilities, structures, buildings, machines, equipment, processes, work systems, projects, communication systems, transportation systems, and industrial or consumer products or equipment of control systems, communications, mechanical, electrical, hydraulic, pneumatic, petroleum, nuclear, mining, chemical, environmental, or equipment of a thermal nature, insofar as they involve safeguarding of life, health, or property, include such other professional services, on and on. And it strikes me that having worked in the mining industry in particular, that's where my experience is, that description covers a great number of the job descriptions of people who are currently working in mining that are not engineers. And I'm wondering if this is going to impact that.
Representative Jorgensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the questions. There are two items there. One, this definition of both items is taken from the model law, which we are trying to get closer to. Those items have been worked out with other professions. Secondly, there is an industrial exemption. Anyone working for an industry on behalf of that industry, which would cover, I believe, the folks you're referring to, are exempt from licensure requirements. The other item which I would like to speak to is it makes my previous point a bit. We used to have a mining engineering program in the state of Wyoming, and we were not able to generate sufficient students to maintain that program. We had a petroleum engineering program at one time, which we dropped for lack of students. We have now reinstated that. So this educating folks in these professions is something that depends on a workforce of students, if you will. And we all know that that's where we suffer as a rural state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 132 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 132 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. After the next bill, House Bill 151, I would like to insert House Bill 88, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, and House Bill 12, Veterans Mental Health Appropriations. So after the next bill, 151, we'll do 88 and 12.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, apparently House Bill 12 has not been rendered yet.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry about that. Then we'll do 88 next. Subject to further announcement.
The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 151. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 151, introduced by Representative Childers, an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding property tax relief program amendments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Henderson, Esquivel K, Gilmore, Lubno, Miller, Semlek, No, Madden, Stubson, Zwanitz, or Dave. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. The bill was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which reported back they did not pass, with a recommendation that it do not pass. Ayes, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, No. Berger, excused. Warren. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Anderson, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 151 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee amendments. I would first move Standing Committee Amendment number one, and I'll let the Chairman of the Appropriation move Standing Committee number two, I think it is, that came from there. This, essentially what the committee, the Standing Committee bill does is change the name from a property tax relief, which it is not. It's a tax relief for disabled and the elderly people over 65. And it also just cuts in half the asset and income levels that are in the are in Bill 151, and changes somewhat the income and the asset level. It changes the definitions of the asset levels to match House Bill, pretty well match House Bill 92, which says $25,000 per person in the house until that bill was amended to go to $50,000 assets. It changes the word resources to assets. If there's any further questions on that, otherwise I'd call for the question.
We are on Standing Committee Amendment number one. Any other discussion of the Standing Committee Amendment? Standing Committee Amendment number one has been moved. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee number one has passed Committee of the Whole. We are now on Standing Committee Amendment number two. Chairman Philp.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment number two to House Bill 151. And what that does is deletes the appropriation, and it appears that there will be enough carryover in the existing account to carry this program forward for at least 1 year and possibly more. It just remains to be seen what the utilization of the program will be. So I ask for your favorable consideration.
Further consideration or further discussion on standing commitment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is an intelligent amendment.
All right. The question having been called on Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to House Bill 151. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to House Bill 151 has passed Committee of the Whole. Chairman Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also tell by that there are a couple more amendments that we kind of want to straighten this out, but the time is of essence, and we'll bring those on second reading. I give the microphone over to the sponsor of the bill to explain just what's going on here.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 151, as the good chairman of the Revenue Committee indicated, it is not a property tax relief program. It is amendments to the elderly and disabled program, an existing program that's probably been in place for at least 5 years or more. And with the bill as amended in the Revenue Committee, basically what this does is a qualified single person whose actual income is less than $17,500 shall receive an $800 basically tax rebate and reduced by the percentage of their income, the actual income exceeding $10,000 a year, and that, in other words, that tapers down from $10,000 a year to the $17,500. At that point, you receive a zero refund, but it starts out at $800. And then for a qualified married person, at least one of whom is at least 65 years of age or totally disabled, whose actual income is less than $28,500, it starts out at $900, and then at the at $16,000 for the married couple, it starts reducing from the $900 until they reach an income level of $28,500. The estimated cost of that change in that program, and again, it's an estimate, is somewhere between $5 and $7 million per year. Again, it depends on the number of applicants. In 2007, there were approximately 3,700 people receiving refunds, an average of $680, and the state paid $2.5 million to the Department of Health for that program. So again, as I said, that it cost an additional $5 to $7 million. Currently in the budget, the Department of Health indicated to me that that program has about $6.2 million in it. So at least for the next year, with the current status of the bill, I think that with the new status, should 151 be approved, that they'll be able to cover any refunds requested and approved. I would say that the bill originally, with a $35,000 income for single person, according to the according statistics put out by a senior citizens group, it would have impacted approximately 50% of those 65 years and older. With the bill as currently amended, it should affect a little less than 30% of the people 65 years of age and older. And for an $800 refund, I think the statistics provided with the property tax refund that was given to you earlier, it'll help significantly for those seniors for the amount of property tax they pay. Quite frankly, with the program, I looked at property tax relief program and I looked at the elderly and disabled, and because the Revenue Committee was considering property tax relief, I brought this bill. I would say that the seniors that I've heard from, part of their problem is not only paying the property taxes, is you have to realize that the elderly also has a problem with increased medical expenses. And how do we address that? We've had a debate on this floor about health-related issues, medical expenses, tort reform, and everything else for about the last 7 years and still hadn't totally addressed it. So I think with this tax relief program, which does not require a constitutional amendment, I think it's one way to help the elderly and disabled. And I would urge your approval, and I'm open for questions if somebody has any.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I urge members of the body to, you know, to read this bill over carefully, you know, and make your mind up on how you feel about it. But read it over carefully. The bill was originally brought forth as a vehicle for property tax relief, and when you read the bill, it's really not a property tax relief bill. You don't have to pay a single penny in property taxes to be totally eligible for this program. In fact, you don't have to pay any taxes to Wyoming whatsoever to be eligible for this program. You could live in a retirement home, and if you could get the application and fill it out, you're eligible for it, even though you haven't spent any money in the taxable sales stream in the state. You don't have to pay any kind of taxes.
it really, all it does say, if you read the bill carefully, is the poorer you are, the bigger the check you get from the state, which is fine. But just realize it's not a property tax or a tax refund, because there's no key, there's no tie-in to what you spend in taxes in order to get it. It just means that the less income you have, the higher your check will be. So really you can call it a negative income tax program. Last year, the average check that was out was $638. I don't know how that average is going to be affected by the amendments that we put in it. It could be higher and it could be lower, but it's going to be, more expensive because more people are going to be involved. I thought I had the amount. It seems like it was about $4 million last year cost. But, just keep in mind that it's not the cure-all for property tax relief like we hope can be incorporated in Bill number 92, but it's more or less a negative income tax for the poor and elderly and disabled. Thank you.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was intended as a tax relief program, and admittedly, people in this state don't pay much in the way of taxes, but they also pay sales taxes, and previous statistics indicate that, of course, this is going back to about 1994, but taxes paid was on the order of 6% total, including property and sales taxes of incomes less than $50,000 a year, and that percentage is probably higher now. So I think this refund, sure, there may be people that do not own homes, but on the other hand, they do pay some taxes in the way of sales taxes. And as I indicated earlier, I think that the people 65 years and of age and older and disabled, you need to remember that this bill is for the disabled, that there are a lot of health-related issues that are tied into there. How do we determine those? We don't have an easy way to determine them. But the elderly and disabled people, I do believe, need some sort of a tax refund, with especially those owning homes. But those that don't, I think they still have increased expenses. So I would urge your passage of this bill.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I believe my question was answered. I was curious as to when this original statute was written, and I think that you said that the numbers we see in here and that this was written in 1994. Is that correct, or do you know when this was written?
Chairman Childers.
No, I'm referring to, Mr. Chairman, referring to some statistics that I had on sales taxes and property taxes paid by the citizens of the state. That was from a Tax Reform 2000 study. I can't tell you exactly when this program started, but it was at least going in the year 2002.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my recollection is this has been with us a long time. It did go have to be reinstituted one time in the last 10 years. But and let's remember, members, half of the people that avail themselves of this, or about half, are disabled, who have very little choices as far as total income. Now, attracted more, it'll be all the elder that the additional be, because the handicap have already been filled there, and it's a good program. Let's remember those people that if they aren't paying any taxes now on their income, the elderly especially, through the years have paid a lot of taxes, most of them, and now it's time that maybe they got a little benefit from that.
Representative Dave Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I can answer the fine chairman from Gillette's question. I believe the program was started in 1998 for people with incomes of $3,500 or less. It was upped in 1999 for incomes of $10,000 or less. In 2006, we raised it to $13,500. This bill originally was to take it up to $35,000. In committee, we cut it back to $17,500. So it's had quite a dramatic increase over the couple last years. Thank you.
Any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with recommendation that House Bill 151 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 151 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 88. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 88, introduced by the Select Water Committee, an act relating to water development, omnibus water bill planning. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended be do pass. Ayes, Blake, Brechtel, Dirks, Edmonds, Samuelson, Semlich, Teeters, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Samuelson, Chairman. The bill was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Samuelson, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 88 do pass. And I will defer to the Vice Chairman of the Ag Committee from House District 2 for the explanation.
Representative Dirks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We bring you House Bill 88, Omnibus Water Bill. And there have been a couple handouts handed out to the body in the last half hour. You can see that we have some Level 1 projects totaling $2.1 million, Level 2 projects $2.3 million. It all adds up to about $5.1 million. And for the new members of the body, a bit of background. I recall the former chairman of the Agriculture Committee, our departed friend from Goshen County, told me that in the early days, every one of these water projects was a separate bill. And if you can imagine every single water project being debated on this body with its merits, and people joining together in various leagues to get one water project through and maybe not another, you can imagine how the emotions were frayed by the end of the session, even more so than what we're experiencing. These days, all these water projects are monitored by the Wyoming Water Development Commission. They've all been scrutinized by the commission, and then through our Select Water Committee. Our Select Water Committee also meets and hears every one of these projects. And then on top of that, the agriculture committees of both chambers hear these projects. So they are very, very well scrutinized. They are important. But because of the time factor, we're not going to go into them individually. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman. If there are any questions, you can address them to the chairman of the Select Water Committee.
Any other discussion on House Bill 88? Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Mr. Chairman, I need to declare a conflict of interest on this bill.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I encourage the body to definitely vote for this. I'm on Select Water. As pointed out, we've had numerous areas of scrutiny, lots of check on this, the Water Commission, and this is something we need to go forward on. There are various phases on this bill, but it is well put together, and I encourage your favorable vote.
Are you? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'll be seeing a construction bill coming over from the Senate. It's quite a bit thicker than this one. We hope we don't spend any more time on it than we will this. This is a planning one. There are several stages in the plan. Sometimes we get confused with water account 1, water account 2, and water account 3, and level 1, level 2, and level 3 studies. They're definitely different, and it depends on where the water, the money's come from. Of course, all the money is flows into this account from the severance tax distribution, and
if there's any questions now or afterwards, be sure and get a hold of one of the Select Water and ask those questions, and we'd be more than willing to answer.
Representative Yagi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to speak in favor of these water development projects. If we don't secure our water, tie up our water, and take care of them, take care of it, we have a chance of losing it to states all around that would just really like to tie up more of Wyoming's water. So I just encourage these water development projects, bills to go forward. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Samuelson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 88 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 88 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
After House Bill 143 at the bottom of, well, wherever it is on your page, House Bill 143, insert House Bill 82, Trauma Care Services, and House Bill 133, Taxation of Helium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Yagi.
Could I have privilege of the floor, please?
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Really like everyone to recognize. I thought he was my good friend until he asked me to run for this House seat. He didn't tell me everything that was involved, and as we were here till 8:30 last night, I'm just really wondering what kind of a friend he is. But I'd like to introduce former House District 18 member Mick Powers.
Thank you, and I appreciate all the good work you do. And now that I'm a county commissioner, send us some money.
The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 117. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 117, introduced by Representative Harvey, an act relating to educational services for preschool children with disabilities. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Wallace, White, No, Teeters, signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. The bill was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren, signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman McComey, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 117 do pass. And there is a standing committee amendment, and I'll have the good gentleman from Appropriations just move that.
Chairman Philp.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 117, and what it does is makes it so that in the event there's an increase, well, or a decrease, that they would have to prepare an exception budget request so it will not just roll over into the standard budget. And then we changed it so that rather than automatically get an increase in the remote chance that it was a decrease, that they could adjust the amounts down if necessary. So we just changed the word increase to adjust. And I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Having heard the motion on Standing Committee Number 1 to House Bill 117, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Standing Committee Number 1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. House Bill, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 117 has passed Committee of the Whole. We're back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the bill over to its sponsor, the good lady from House District 26.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
During the budget process, there was some considerable debate, and this developmental preschool funding caused a letter from the governor to be sent up so that it could be fully funded. And apparently in the language, it was a little bit confusing as to how the money would move forward. Just as a refresher, the budget process begins in the summertime. The agencies prepare their budget. They turn it over to the governor, who turns it over to the Appropriations Committee on December 1st, and to all of us, really, on December 1st. December 1st is a significant date for the developmental preschools. It's the date that their federal child count numbers are due. And so this is the number that is used every year to establish how many children are enrolled in the developmental preschool programs. What it does is it changes on page 2, line 6 and 7. It does change up until December 1st. As they're preparing the budget, they need to use estimates. But on December 1st, they need to turn that into the real child count number. And that this is the clarification that states that on line 6. It changes it from the current fiscal year to the year in which the budget request is being prepared. And then down on line 18 is the other significant part of this, and it says the intent of this subsection is for each budget request to incorporate all previous adjustments made pursuant to this subsection. And so what that says is that once the ECA that is granted to the public schools is also added to the preschool budget, that it then becomes a part of the standard budget. And I stand for questions.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not rising today to debate the validity of the preschool developmental disability program. There's no doubt that it is effective and appropriate. JAC, if you'll note, I'm looking on my cheat sheet, page 9, section 6, JAC added $8.1 million for preschool developmental disability programs pursuant to the governor's letter for adjusted child counts, social-emotional services, and an external cost adjustment. I think that's the appropriate way to deal with getting more money to the developmental preschools. We can look at this every biennium or every year, for that matter, and apply an external cost adjustment. And if we have the resources and we determine that it's feasible to go ahead and do this, if we put this external cost adjustment on, it's like putting the train in fifth gear and jumping out. We have no idea where we're going. We have no idea how fast it's going to go. There's no way to control the costs. I think I have some serious concern about that. If you look at the fiscal note, fiscal year 2010, it's going to be $1.1 million into the additional $62 million that we're allocating into this program. And for fiscal year 2011, we're up to $2.4 million. I don't know where we're headed. That's one question I would have for the sponsor. Any projections or ideas as to where we're going to be in 5 years? On and against the bill.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can tell you exactly where we're headed. Today, in special education programs in K through 12, we serve 13.5% of the population in special education services. The developmental preschools serve just under 9%. The national statistic is that about 10.5% of the kids, birth through 5, have significant enough developmental delays or disabilities that would qualify them for the developmental preschools. Several years ago, we implemented the 1-before-2 program that encourages parents to have children screened for their developmental readiness before they're 2 years old, one screening before the age of 2. That program has been wildly successful, and we are identifying children. The good news is that as these children are getting their brains hardwired, where we're headed is a reduction in the children that are served in special education K through 12. The number spent on the children in the developmental preschools is considerably less than special education in K through 12. And when you consider K through 12 being 13 years of school versus 5 years in the developmental preschool, I think that we're headed for some cost savings. The other significant thing about this bill is that it is not a policy change. It's a change that we implemented a year ago. This policy is already in place, and the only thing that this bill does is clarify in the budget language exactly the policy that we have already enacted. Our budget office requested a change to eliminate the confusion as they're figuring out these budgets. And so there is no policy change. This is simply a language clarification.
Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not here to debate the validity of the program. I think it does save us money in the long run. I'm here to debate how we apply the external cost adjustment. And I think the budget is the appropriate place to do that, because then we can look at all the other things we want to fund and determine whether or not we can afford to do that. In the bill, in existing language, we are funding at $8,503 per child. If that's not adequate, then let's talk about what it costs, and let's change that number instead of putting on something that we can't control in the future. And that's my big concern here. The governor's request was responsible. JAC's response was responsible. Putting this thing in overdrive and turning loose of the steering wheel is not. And I would ask for no vote.
Any other discussion on the bill? The question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill 117 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 117 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 143. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 143, introduced by Representative Alden. An act relating to Memorial Hospital Districts. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Gilmore, Illaway, Martin, Meyer, Miller, Korberg, Stubbs, and Zwanitzer Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
Chairman Illaway, you've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 143 do pass, and I would turn it over to the good representative from District 3.
Representative Alden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 143 is fairly simple and fairly straightforward. I propose that there be an expansion in the definition to the Memorial Hospital District's use of their mill levy. Currently, in my county, as I'm sure is existing in many counties throughout the state, our hospitals and nursing homes are facing either remodeling or new facilities. Our facility in Platte County was built in 1957. We have a hospital district that could, in fact, if this bill is enacted into statute, that would enable the hospital district, their percentage of the mill levy is now restricted to the support of operations and maintenance. And our county contracts with an operator. That operator furnishes the maintenance and operational issues. Our hospital district, with this, the passage of this bill into law, would be able to utilize that percentage of the mill levy towards construction or towards the purchase of hospital equipment. And we all know that the hospital equipment, it carries a fairly heavy monetary figure behind it. The cost of hospital equipment could be accrued, and small construction projects it would be able to be utilized for. And to as costs escalate, this money could be secured in a fund that could perhaps purchase the equipment within a three-year period. It could also be used to as match money to a SLID board loan to various other funding sources. So it could be a pledge to a revenue stream against a loan or bonds to buy equipment. If we could expand the language in just that area to include this, I think it would be very beneficial to what our hospitals are facing now and in the near future. Thank you. I would appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few questions for the bringer of the bill. I'm just a little confused as to the placement I totally agree with what you're attempting to do. I have no problem with that, but just the placement of where you've put the language. You kept referring to hospital district, and in this section in Title 18, you're dealing with county hospitals, which are different than hospital districts, but because hospital districts are over in Title 35. So I just wanted to make sure that this will cover you, and maybe over in 35 it says flip over to Title 18 to cover you. I'm not sure. And then also, what you're doing in 102, 18.8.102, it actually says in 102, well, it actually says over in 103, it says money, the fund shall be created and added to from taxation as provided by 18.8.102. So it appears that money collected under 102 can be deposited into the construction fund under 103. So it appears to me that you already have your authority. I'm just curious if there was some type of legal opinion that called that into question, and that's what brought in the need for this. Because when you read 18.8.103, it appears to already allow for the taxation money collected to be used for construction purposes. So I guess I have two questions. If I wanted to make sure that we were doing the right thing for you and this was being placed in the right spot. And number two, was there a legal opinion saying that wasn't enough, that the statute already says it can be used for construction?
Thank you.
Senator Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, good representative from Teton County. Excellent questions, and they certainly merit some response. It's my understanding that there was no official legal opinion regarding this. However, it's also my understanding that those county attorneys that deal with this, those attorneys that represent the county commissioners and the hospital districts that deal with this, needed a more definitive enhancement of this particular area of the law. And for that, I'm going to defer to the good representative from Albany who has had numerous years of direct experience in this area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, as to the use of the word district, I would submit to the representative from District 23 that was probably a misspeak. There are basically three kinds of hospitals in the state of Wyoming: private hospitals, county memorial hospitals, and district hospitals. And I think the word district was used, but I think the reference was really to county memorial hospital, which is Title 18, Chapter 8, and that's where we are. As to the second question, I'm reading on the fly here, but I think that these attorneys are asking for a tie in 18.8.102B. I think they're asking for a tie to 18.8.103 so that they can use the 18.8.102B funds not only for, make it clear that they can use them not only for maintenance, but they can also use them for construction projects. 18.8.102B down on the part that's being amended says that the tax can be used to provide for the maintenance of the hospital or wing or portion thereof. And I think they just want some language in there that makes it clear that it could also be used for self-funded projects that the hospital board would care to undertake. And I will grant you that in 188103 it says that the fund created there can be added to from 188102 funds, although 188102 also addresses bonded indebtedness. And so I think that creates an anomaly there that I think they'd like to clear up. And so I think the net result of it would be that not the bonded indebtedness money, but the tax mill levy money, it'd be undisputed that besides being used for maintenance, it could be used for construction, small construction projects in the hospital that didn't really fit in the category of maintenance.
Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to stand on and for this bill. I want you to know, I just think that all of us know what the hospitals are going through, and we need to give them as much latitude as they need as we can for them to do the projects that they need to do to keep running. Thank you.
Are we ready for the question on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with a recommendation that House Bill 143 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 143 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 82. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 82, introduced by Representative Lockhart, an act relating to medical care regarding trauma care service. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Esquivel K., Hales, Hallinan, Harvey, Eichel, Landon, Lubno, Millen. Conflict, Stewart. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Landon?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 82 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I will turn over the explanation of the bill to the good representative from the Windy Casper country.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, from the windy city of Casper. We had a great segue into this particular bill with the one you just heard and voted on. This particular bill, House Bill 82, Trauma Care Services, was one that has quite a legislative history. Several years ago, the Health Care Commission pointed out that trauma care had $20-plus million worth of uncompensated care. From that, the legislature took on a $2.5 million funding for trauma care, and it was to be spread in a certain way across the trauma care hospitals and those who provided trauma care in the way of ambulance and education and so forth. Last year, we passed a bill very similar to the one that's in front of you today that passed the House handily with the $2.5 million. It got to the organization down the hall, and it went through the standing committee, appropriations, and then died for lack of time. So we're back with a bill that has $2.5 million in it. It has been through appropriations. And since you heard it all last year, appropriations ran us through a very rigorous discussion yesterday and came out with a support of the bill. As you can see, there's no amendment from appropriations. They stayed with the $2.5 million that's in there. I think in the order of making sure some people get their bills heard, I would just stand for questions on the trauma care bill that's in front of you. I did pass out a information sheet, a two-pager. It shows, among other things, how the original $2.5 million was dispersed, and you can see that covered numerous hospitals throughout our state, and this service is touched just about everybody around our state, and both picking up people from accidents, treating them when they get to the hospitals, and educating people on how to handle trauma care. I stand for questions.
Representative David Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As some of you may remember from the general session, I was the only no vote on this bill as it came through. So I noticed on introduction this time there's 8 no votes. I was watching for this bill to come through the governor's budget, and I did not see it. I watched it to see if it was coming through the JAC budget, and I did not see it. And as I look around the state, I see hospitals are still growing, at least the ones in this part of the state. They're getting bigger and bigger. My assertion, and I won't go into a long speech, it'll be the same as it was during the general session, as hospitals get organized, as they get going, that they realize that the trauma care center is kind of a necessary evil as far as it affects their bottom line. I understand what the trauma cares do. I've had a couple of discussions. I'm very appreciative of what they do. And as we all know, we would not want to be in that situation where we'd have to declare a conflict here, thinking that we may be the one on the other end of needing this bill. It's simply just a cost of doing business, ladies and gentlemen. The hospitals have bore this burden since they started, and we're still bearing it. I think they've looked at the state of Wyoming and say, we have a lot of money. Let's come and see if we can get some of it. I would encourage a no vote. Thank you.
Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just to lift the helicopter off of the number 2 trauma care center in Casper, we have only 2 trauma care centers in our state, as most of you, I'm sure, are aware of. And the one in Casper serviced by the helicopter service picks up patients all over throughout our whole coal production and oil production fields, and serves a very wide range. To lose our number 2 trauma care center, I think would be devastating to our state. I really do. And I have been in conference with the folks, at least in Casper, and I'm sure that the folks in Cheyenne have similar concerns, but the trauma care center, it really has kind of a bleak outlook right now, and they're really not asking for much. The amount of money that would actually come out of this for the trauma care center in Casper would probably maybe not quite cover the ambulance service. I ask you to please consider supporting this. Thank you.
Representative Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As one who has attended about 20 years of hospital board meetings in my other life, I'd like to note that one of the things I hear come up on a repetitive basis is this uncompensated trauma care. It's a problem that just keeps coming up, doesn't go away, so I would encourage your support of House Bill 82. Thank you.
Representative Bagby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to refer you to page 5 in the bill, line D, or 4, paragraph 4, reimbursing hospitals for trauma service costs and ambulance services for transporting patients to a hospital or emergency room. Now, my hospital covers I-80, and it also covers Highway 30, and it also covers westbound to Wamsutter. And this winter has been absolutely horrific. We have had so many ambulances go out. We've had so many wrecks. A lot of those people are tourists. They've never driven on snow. They get to the hospital. They don't have any insurance. The hospital has to pay the cost. And it's a major cost to our hospitals. So I would ask for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to say, I don't think this is just for trauma centers. It's for hospitals. It's for ambulances. And that's becoming a bigger problem all the time. In our area right now, we have so many people coming in there, and the growth is just tremendous. And a lot of those people have to have hospital care, and a lot of those people don't pay their bills. And I think that we need to think about what's happening throughout the state. This is a very important bill. This straps our hospitals every single year. And I urge you to vote for this. Thank you.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I do need to declare a conflict on this. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to take issue with the contention in the discussion in opposition of this bill. Number one, we're talking about cost shifting. We're talking about who ought to pay the bill. Hospitals have no choice. And you have to understand that when a medical situation presents at a hospital, the hospital is going to deal with it. If they had a choice, then some of those arguments that were made might make sense. And they might say, well, we'll take some patients. We won't take others. We'll do what a lot of corporations do. We'll figure out what our market is. We'll look at the market segments we want to serve, and we'll structure ourselves in such a way that we serve those and we discard the rest. And we might even use some variation of the 80-20 rule that we heard this morning. And, there's the old thing about, and I've seen professionals do it, where they sift through all their accounts and they say, well, 80% of my clients are paying 20% of the money, 20% of my clients are paying 80% of the money. Why don't I kick the 80% of my clients out, work for the 20% for 80% of the money and 20% of the phone calls? So all that sort of thing can go on in business, but it can't go on with hospitals. And to just say, well, the hospitals just build it in. They've just accepted the fact that they're gonna provide these services. That is a disingenuous statement. They have built it in because they're required by law to build it in. And there's no free lunch in this world, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody is paying the bill. So the question is, who's paying? Now, back to what I said. There's basically three kinds of hospitals in the state of Wyoming. There's private hospitals, there's county memorial hospitals, and there's district hospitals. Well, if it's a county memorial hospital and it's losing money, the county commissioners are paying the bill. The other two kinds of hospitals, hospital districts and private hospitals, those patients have to pay the bill. And you look at these, you pick out any hospital in the state of Wyoming that you want to look at and go look at their bad debts, and it is horrendous. And every time I see a new person come on the hospital board, the first thing they do is die. They fall out of their chair and almost die when they look at the write-offs that are going through that hospital. Well, who's bearing the cost of those write-offs? In some cases, it's the county commissioners. In other cases, it's the patients. It's a disparate, fractured method of spreading the cost. And what this bill does is bring the cost of these back to where it ought to be. It spreads it to the whole of society through a taxing mechanism and makes us all pay our share instead of moving it disproportionately to some group of people who are caught in this thing and have to pay the price. So that's why this is fair. It's why it's needed. It's good for the hospitals. It's good for society. It's good morally, and I would urge you to support it.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the bill, but I definitely have some questions for the bringer of the bill. The first one is, I couldn't help but notice, but the previous time we did this, we put it in statute, and I went back and looked, and it was in 35-2901. In this bill, it appears you're just going to put it in the session laws. I was just curious as to why we're doing it that way. My second question has to do with this handout that was given out, and that the two major hospitals in the state received their 25%. You can get up to a maximum of 25%. And the fiscal note said they received it within the first 3 months of the appropriation being given out the last time. And actually all the money ran out within the first 3 months, the fiscal note said. I was just curious, when you go down the list, a bunch of these other hospitals aren't actually asking for very much. Is that because, and I'm just surmising here, does most of the trauma cases end up being transferred to one of those two major hospitals, and that's why they're ending up with the high cost. I'm just curious as to why some of these other hospitals haven't asked for any. I noticed the one in Lincoln County, they asked for $7,000. I'm just curious as to why there's such a difference. It looks like Afton asked for $4,000, and maybe some representatives from those that part of the state could answer those. Just a curiosity question.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been here 8 years and have defended a lot of bills. This is the first time I've had so much defense of questions that are being asked about the bill. As to the last questioner from House District 23, the record you see on that handout was what was done in the first $2.5 million that were out. My understanding of each of the hospitals that received a bill for trauma care expense, those small ones that you saw from Afton and some of the other communities, were for ambulance services that were brought to those hospitals. Those hospitals turned around and accessed these funds to compensate those volunteers primarily who were supporting trauma care transportation. So I think that answers the question. As far as the question about in 3 months it was used up the last time, there is a built-in time delay between the time they submit a bill for collection from the fund, and they delay that as long as they can to ensure that anybody that has insurance or ability to pay has paid and then dip into the fund. If they don't, it's a way of making sure that the fund is used properly. The only other question that I really had was from House District 9, as I interpreted his discussion, and we have by state statute the responsibility for trauma care at our hospitals, and that's why we take on these costs, even though they're not compensated, and it's certainly something we don't want to transfer only to the people who have insurance. So it is a fairness issue by the state doing this. It is a state law that has the trauma care a responsibility. I urge your support of the bill.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. By my count, there are 45 of us who haven't spoken on this bill. To supplement the information provided by the good chairman from House District 57, the federal government passed a statute a few years ago called EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatments Act. And what they said is if you have a hospital, you have to take everybody who presents at your hospital and you have to treat them and stabilize them before you can transfer them. And so every hospital is required by federal law, if they have an emergency department, to take everybody who comes to the door. And that's one of the core services that the federal government has determined that we, if we operate hospitals, have to supply. And those services are provided regardless of ability to pay, as they should be in emergency situations. But somebody has to pay. Now, as to the question about why the tertiary care centers, we have a state trauma plan, and we have area trauma hospitals, and then we have tertiary care centers. There are two tertiary care centers located in the two biggest cities in the state, and then a whole series of area trauma hospitals who have surgeons who can treat and stabilize. But the most complicated cases get transferred via the helicopters to the area trauma or to the tertiary care centers. And so the costs of treating the most complicated patients end up with those hospitals. And so the reason that they get a lion's share of the money from this program is because they bear far more than a lion's share of the costs in this program. And so that's why it sets out that way.
Representative Millen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You can reduce that number to 44 now, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. I just wanted to say, as someone who works in an operating room assisting surgeons, trauma, when we are there saving lives, we aren't worried about how we're getting compensated. We're just doing that. Here working in Cheyenne, we're the only level 2 trauma center in this state. Beyond that, you'd have to go to Colorado. And just a few statistics, I guess, some things I wanted to say that
You know, the trauma systems are really about providing quality expert care to the residents. And trauma care is the leading killer of people in ages 1 to 44 in Wyoming. So it's not just about traffic accidents. We deal with injuries from ranching accidents, rodeos, childhood injuries, and so on. And so I just wanted you to know that I support this bill and encourage your aye vote.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just informing the body, this is really just cost for this fiscal year, and that's on page 4 of the bill. It could easily come back. Somebody could come. We had an amendment to make a choice with the Wildlife Trust Fund earlier. I thought it was a good amendment. And I think, you know, you could. This is just a drop in a bucket. You could do another $2.5 million for the next fiscal year. Again, this is just to take us through July of this year. This money will be gone. But our trauma, the testimony we've heard, is our trauma care system is on a shoestring budget. This is an important service. We're just sparse population, and so I encourage your support, and I think we could probably do more and encourage that on third reading amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard the words cost of doing business. Well, maybe. Let's talk about that. Here's how it works. You have a major hospital somewhere. They have no choice, as you've heard, no choice but to take a trauma case and to provide that care. Often the care provided isn't paid for some reason or another. People, believe this or not, many people that choose not to use a seatbelt do not have insurance. The statistics will show you that to be true. Why that's the case, I don't know. But the cost of that, the hospital has no choice but to push it off onto people that private pay, whether they pay cash, whether they pay with a combination of cash or insurance or however, that's how it works. The cost shifting starts. They push it on to the people that have private pay, that pay themselves, that have insurance, and guess what happens? All of a sudden you end up with a day rate when you have to have a surgical procedure in the hospital of $1,000, $1,200, $1,500, $2,000 a day. That's how it works. They have no choice but to do that. Fewer people. Let's go to the next step. Fewer people can afford insurance because the prices of it are going up. The numbers of employers in this state, as the prices of group life and health insurance go up, simply say, I can no longer afford to pay for it for my employees. The numbers of employees with insurance go down. The cost spiral continues. The numbers of people able to or willing to pay are shrinking. The people that are unwilling to pay are growing. Why that's the case, I don't know. But in a very tremendous, expensive trauma case, who gets to pay that? Well, that goes to the private payer. Many of us, many people that we know that still are able to afford insurance. Okay, if you're a hospital in the center of the state, you inherit a lot of problems within 100 miles from that particular location. And you know what I'm talking about. Here, a few words for you to consider. Carbon, Fremont, Converse, Johnson, Natrona. That's a lot of landmass, folks. It's a lot of area, and it's a lot of problems. So we say cost of doing business for who? The people that are providing insurance? The people that are private paying into a hospital? That's the one that's sharing the cost, because that hospital is going to make money one way or the other, and they just don't print money. They get it from the people that pay. So, yes, it's cost sharing, and it's a cost of doing business, but it's a cost of doing business to the individual, the employer that provides insurance for his employees, and they go to use that facility, and all of a sudden you get a shocking bill. So, yeah, it's a cost of doing business, all right, but to the employers of the state and the people that private pay.
Representative David Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate all the comments from my colleagues. You brought up some very, very good points. I would just like to leave you with three or four or five, and I always try to be a little short. Number one, I totally agree with the cost that it takes to run a trauma center, and I totally agree with the benefits of a trauma center. But, folks, we're paying for it one way or the other. If the state puts the money in, the taxpayers are paying for it. If the state's not putting the money in, then it does go off into the other individuals in the hospital. I'll get back to that point in just a second. I have not heard of any hospitals in the state that are ready to close their doors because they financially cannot make it. I just have not heard of that. Another point, should we help the retailers of the state? cover their cost of shoplifting? I don't know. It's a cost of doing business. You have to make it up somewhere, folks. And look at the list. If you looked at the list, two of the major hospitals get $800,000. There's one hospital there that gets $4,000, one that gets $7,000, one that gets $12,000. Is that really going to make a difference? I do not know. But my biggest point is, will the trauma care patients see a bill that shows a discount because the state of Wyoming's paying part of the tab? Ask yourself that. I still ask you to vote against it. Thank you.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My effort to have a very brief discussion about a bill didn't work out quite as planned. I appreciate all of the comments that were made on the bill. I think the questions have been answered. I urge your support of it. And as a last coup de grace, this bill was drafted originally by Tom Walsh. When he could no longer be down here with us, I agreed to step in as the sponsor of the bill. So let's do this one for Tom Walsh.
Are you ready for the question? The question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 82 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 82 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Very quickly, privilege of the floor. We have two of our great county commissioners with us up in the balcony to my left, to your right, Barb Perriam, and the chairman. shows how quickly we forget. Rob Henry. Rob will make me pay for that.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
Go ahead, sir.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I've never introduced two privileges of the floor in one day, but today's the day. Again, from Fremont County, from Central Wyoming College, we have a number of students and a couple of faculty members sitting above me in the west balcony here. Including in that group is Matt Huxtable, happens to be from Shoshone, and he's the Wyoming Community College Student of the Year. So along with Matt, we have Jim Thorman, Wayne Montgomery, Reva Devaney, and Kurt Galactic. So please welcome them.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Folks, don't get too excited. We're going to rise and report here and read in a few bills and then go back into general file. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The motion carries.
Mr. Chairman.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Joint Resolution Number 6, recommended do pass. House Bill 128, amended. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill was deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill Number 52, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 141, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 160, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 10, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Simpson moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 145, amended and further amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 173, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 102, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 113, recommended do pass. House Bill 77, recommended do pass. House Bill 118, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 132, recommended do pass. House Bill 151, amended, and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Lubnow announced a conflict of interest on House Bill 88, recommended do pass. House Bill 117, recommended do pass. House Bill 143, recommended do pass. House Bill 82, Representative Stewart announced a conflict of interest on House Bill 82, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Stubson, Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed to the motion signify by saying no. Congratulations, Representative Stubson. Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, you may.
I'd like to introduce the commissioners that probably come the farthest and from the very best county, Lincoln, Jerry Harmon, Kent Conley, and Tammy Archibald. Thank you.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 9 engrossed, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Alden, Bagby, Dockstetter, Mercer, Olson, Shepperson, Throne, no, Gingrey. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 52, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Alden, Bagby, Buchanan, Dockstetter, Mercer, Olson, Shepperson, no, Gingrey, Throne. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 12, respectfully reports same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 108, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Peterson, Philp, no, Jorgensen, Warren. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 153, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number four, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 134, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 127, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Escobel K., Harvey, Landon, Lubnow, Stewart, no, Hales, Hallinan, Millen, excused, Eichel. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House resolve itself into Committee of the Whole.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. All of those opposed to the motion signify by saying no. Representative Stubson.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, here is a new order for you. House Bill 133. House Bill 11. House Bill 12. House Bill 96. Excuse me, 98. House Bill 134. And House Bill 137. Again, 133, 11, 12, 98, 134, and 137.
The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 133. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 133, introduced by Representative Anderson. This act relating to taxation and revenue regarding the taxation of helium. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Escobel, Kay, Gilmore, Lubnow, Madden, Semlich, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave, No, Miller, signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 133, House Bill 133, do pass. And I will attempt to explain the bill. Those of you, probably many of you, know the genesis of this helium bill. One of our major producers in the state has been producing helium for some time. And the taxation was done under a contract. That contract was canceled because of different reasons than the helium. And so they took that taxation of helium to the Supreme Court. And about a year ago, we got a Supreme Court decision that said under the present statutes, we could not collect severance tax on helium gas because it belonged when it came out of the wellhead, it belonged to the U.S. government under a 1920 law. So we came with a committee bill in December to tax the extraction of minerals rather than the production of minerals, and that had some holes in it. So that was turned down by the committee, and so we went back to the Attorney General and said, can we figure out a way that we could put in the statutes that helium, we'd be able to collect that 6% severance tax on helium. And this is the bill that we have that came out of committee that will make it so that we can follow the statutory and rules that all minerals produced in Wyoming should be taxed with severance tax. We had plenty of testimony in the committee why it should not be taxed. There is a little part of the bill that you need to understand. Legislative intent is in the bill. That is not real customary for us to pass a bill with legislative intent, although there are places that's been done. It's decided by the committee that this is one that follows the exception rule, and we left it in that bill. And if there's any further questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Otherwise, I call for the question on the bill.
Any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with recommendation that House Bill 133 do pass, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. House Bill 133 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 11. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 11, introduced by Representative Wallace, an act relating to health and safety regarding Wyoming homemade products. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Edmonds, Esquivel, F., Hammonds, Harvey, Meyer, Korberg. No, Lockhart, Stewart. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Lockhart? Paging Chairman Lockhart. Chairman Lockhart, what's your pleasure?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 11 do pass, and there is a standing committee amendment, and I urge its support, and I'll turn the working of the bill over to the good representative from House District 52.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I just have a mind blank here. Do I need to do the standing committee amendment first and then?
We need to move the standing committee number one first. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess in my wraparound here, I didn't say what I meant to say, and that is I urge the adoption of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and then turn it over to the good representative from House District 52.
Is there any discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 11? Question being called. All in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 11, signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there is a Committee of the Whole amendment. Should I take care of that now?
Why don't you move the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1?
All right. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, and basically this amendment takes care of the remaining agency concerns that were not addressed by the standing committee amendments, clarifies the definition of a homemade operation so that an apartment in a primary residence does not disqualify someone, adds a phone number to the contact requirements on the label, and adds to the phrase must be printed on the label so that it will read this product is home produced and not subject to state inspection, and would call for the question.
Any further discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1? The question being called, all those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has passed. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the 59th, I stand before you a voracious reader and eater. In January, I read Michael Pollan's In Defense of Food and Eater's Manifesto, wherein he lauds the delicious and nutritious traditions of authentic, unmessed with, real, honest-to-goodness, homemade, homegrown food. I like his rules of eating. Never eat anything your grandmother would not recognize as food. Never eat anything that makes a health claim. Avoid food products containing ingredients that are unfamiliar or unpronounceable. Get out of the supermarket. You are what your food eats too. Eat like an omnivore. Eat well-grown foods from healthy soils. Eat wild foods when you can, and keep your food chain as short as possible. This bill defines what a home and a Wyoming homemade operation is and what food can be produced. It defines and prohibits potentially hazardous food. It requires labeling necessary for the public safety. It exempts Wyoming homemade operations from licensing and inspection. And it comes with amendments to clarify that these products may only be made and sold in Wyoming, that having a mother-in-law's apartment in your home won't disqualify you on the basis of too many ovens to meet the definition, and allows the Department of Agriculture to establish reasonable rules and regulations to protect the public health. Any product that is potentially hazardous, as defined by the Department of Agriculture and this legislation, cannot be sold. In practical terms, this means that it's limited to baked goods, jams, jellies, preserves, and fruit butters. Should this legislation survive its ride to the western side and downstairs, a Wyoming homemade operator could legally sell their products at farmers markets, stores, and events in Wyoming, so long as it is for home consumption. It could not be served in restaurants. The department does have the authority to sample homemade products and have them lab tested, but there is no requirement for them to test every batch. I will tell you that the opposition we heard was entirely from the food inspectors, who felt that this was a dangerous precedent to allow good cooks in their own homes to make intrinsically safe food and sell it to the public without government inspection. I believe, as do an amazingly vocal segment of all of your constituents, that this is bureaucratic overkill. The other friendly disagreement that remains with the department is in regards to the fiscal note. This bill contains no appropriation. It was our feeling that there are already state and local food inspectors in every community in the state who are already regulating farmers markets and stores, and that the addition of these products to the local economies would not represent much of an impact. The department maintains that this fiscal note represents what they think they might have to absorb in terms of administrative impact. Folks, this is economic development. It invigorates our local food systems. It brings our communities together. It enhances our tables and satisfies our bellies. I would ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 11 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 12. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 12, introduced by the Mental Health and Act Relating to Military Affairs Regarding Veterans Mental Health Appropriations. This bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Edwards, Escobel, F., Hallinan, Hammonds, Madden, Slater, White, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Edwards, Chairman. The bill was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Edwards, what is your pleasure? Chairman Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill number 12, Veterans Mental Health Appropriations. And I will discuss the bill. Who's the sponsor? I don't know. I think we should ask the representative from House District 23.
Huh? Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Apologize for not being here right away. This is the Select Committee on Mental Health and Substance Abuse looked at this bill this summer. The veterans got together. We actually put together a study group made up of many people across the state who came together to look at mental health issues of veterans. And they came together with this idea. It became apparent that the federal government should probably be responsible for this, but for whatever reason, it was not occurring. So what happened was there was this idea that the state should take over this responsibility. It's an amount of $848,000. If you look through the bill, you'll see how it's broken down. The major portion of it is $440,000. I believe that's the correct amount, which is available.
Oh, thanks.
Which is available for two contract employees to travel the state of Wyoming and assist folks that are returning from Iraq and Afghanistan to get them into contact with the mental health and some abuse providers that can give them the treatment that they need. That's the main part of the bill. Then there's some other parts of it. There is $68,000 provided to provide reimbursement to physicians that do the assessments. There's also $250,000, what's called quality of life. This is when a soldier, it's been determined that that soldier needs to be sent to, or not sent, but go to a treatment provider out of state or far from his home, that they would go there and that they would have some money to pay for a hotel room, for the mileage to get there, and mostly for the family to be able to survive while the soldier is receiving that treatment. $40,000 for the training of physicians on how to recognize war-related injuries, and then lastly, $50,000 to train community leaders and employers on how to help those soldiers reintegrate and transition back into the community. And I would stand for any questions if you had any.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Edwards' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill 12 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 12 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 98. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 98, introduced by Representative Esquivel Ken, an act relating to professions and occupations regarding speech pathologist licensing. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Edmonds, Esquivel F., Hammonds, Harvey, Lockhart, Korberg, Stewart, excused, Meyer, signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 98 do pass, and I urge your support. And I'll turn the management of the bill over to the good representative from House District 41.
Representative Esquivel K.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my privilege to bring you House Bill 98, and at this time I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 and ask for the, well, let me explain that one real quick. That changes on page 3, line 12, the date from 2008 to 2012, and that amendment just makes it a little more easier for those people that are currently working to attain that degree of audiology. Those are the national minimum standards. It just makes this bill a little more friendly for those people that are currently pursuing that audiology degree, and I'd ask for the question.
Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, we're on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You should have a handout in your box, and that one does highlight those repeals. I did mention earlier that it had been 30 years since we had updated that section, and the main part of the bill after the doctor degree, which is 33-33105A, Romanet I, is the provisional licensing. Currently, speech pathologist graduates are working as techs or assistants during their fellowship year. This bill will allow them to work as that fellowship year with a provisional license. So in places like the local child development centers here in Cheyenne that have 500 kids where there's one licensed speech pathologist in that room, those assistants and techs have to be in the room with her. This provisional license will allow those child development centers to spread them out through different rooms so they're helping more kids at the same time, and also will help us deal with those workforce issues, retainment and retention for those graduates working on their fellowship year to stay in the state of Wyoming. Currently, we're about 100 speech pathologists short, and if there aren't any questions, I'd call for the question.
Any discussion on the bill? Seeing no discussion. Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill number 98 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 98 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, after House Bill 134, I'd like to insert House Bill 53 and House Bill 153.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill number 134. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 134, introduced by Representative Stubson, an act relating to school districts regarding immunity and liability insurance. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey's out in the hallway. Would somebody remind him he's got a bill up? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 134 do pass. And with that, I would turn the explanation of the bill over to the sponsor, the good gentleman from the Tarawana County.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is really a clarifier and a fixer for the insurance provisions that govern school districts. We have had testimony in support of it from those associations that represent our local school boards. But essentially what it does is there's some confusing language that you can see on page 2 of the bill that struck out, that now the insurance requirements that are placed on school districts requires a maximum of $50,000 or more of insurance. It creates some confusion of what that means, whether it's $50,000 or up to infinity. A second area of confusion comes in because the school districts are included under the definition of governmental entities, as that term is used in the Governmental Claims Act. And so there are separate insurance provisions in that portion of the statute that could arguably apply to the school districts as well. In order to clarify that confusion, this bill seeks to tie the school district insurance provisions directly into the insurance provisions of the Governmental Claims Act, and that does a couple of things. First of all, it eliminates potential unfunded liability that could arise if school districts, in fact, decided that a maximum of $50,000 in insurance was required under the statute. They only have immunity for liability over $250,000. And so by tying them into the Governmental Claims Act, they are now required to carry insurance for that liability that they are not immune to, and also have the opportunity to carry insurance over and above that amount. The second thing this does is really recognize something that the school districts have been doing already, which is pooling together to try to leverage and get the best deal that they can on insurance. There's currently a couple of school district insurance pools, one I know includes 23 separate school districts.
The reference to Section 139.118c1 and 139.118c2 expressly recognizes what school districts really have started to do already, which is to pool so that they can get the best value on insurance and to enter into agreements that allows for some self-insurance. So this really just modernizes a statute that dates back probably 20, 25 years before the Governmental Claims Act and seeks to eliminate confusion and endorse practices that are already in place. So with that, I will entertain any questions on the bill.
Is there any discussion on the bill? The question being called, all those in favor of Representative McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 34 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill number 134 has passed the House. Chairman Childers. The next order, the next bill on our for our consideration is House Bill number 53. The House, or the reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 53, introduced by Representative Dockstader, an act relating to garnishment of wages. This bill was referred to Committee No. 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Childers, Kraft, Davison, Goggles, Eichel, Yagi, Slater, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 53 do pass, and I'll turn the bill over to the good representative from District 21 to discuss the bill.
Representative Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 53, again, is simply garnishees administrative fees, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration on this. Again, this bill is designed to help the small business. The request came from small business. 53 simply allows the business the opportunity to garnish a $10 fee only if they desire for the administrative responsibilities that's often imposed by them by the courts. Many of us have operated a small business. We know what it's like, the demands, how difficult it is, and the larger businesses can get through this easily. It's the small business we're trying to help here. That's who this bill will help. The bill simply allows a small business an option to help address the demands that are placed upon them without their choice or their input. So I'd ask for your favorable consideration and on this House Bill 53. Thank you.
The question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 53 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 53 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
After House Bill 153, please insert House Joint Resolution 10.
The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 153. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 153, introduced by Representative Lockhart, an act relating to economic development. This bill was referred to Committee No. 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which returned an aye vote. Ayes, Brechtel, Edmonds, Esquivel F., Hammonds, Harvey, Lockhart, Korberg, Stewart, excused, Meyer. The bill was re-referred to Committee No. 2, Appropriations, which recommended a due pass with amendments. Ayes, Berger, Harshman, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren, signed Representative Philp, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 153 do pass, and I further move the adoption. Because this was referred to the Appropriations Committee, I think they have to move the Standing Committee amendment. So I defer to Representative from House District 25.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 153. This is a very simple, very classical Appropriations Committee amendment. I'm sure you can see that. It was determined in the testimony And as we discussed what our financial position is today on our goldenrod and so on, that $2 million would provide ample revenue into this fund, which already contains $1 million. And by realizing that we do come back every year and so on, it was agreed that it would be advisable to reduce that from the 10 down to the 2. So I would encourage your acceptance of this amendment.
Any discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 153? Question being called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment 1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 153 has passed. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is commonly called the Wyoming Challenge Loan Program. It has in the past made 143 loans since 1998 when the Business Council took over the responsibility for this program. They work with local banks. They've currently made, as I mentioned, 143 loans. Most of them are filling a niche in the economic development market that wasn't met other places. The average loan from this fund is $110,000. The average job is 4. I requested a distribution of who got these loans. It's clear across our state, and most of the communities have benefited from this. And as I say, it tends to fill a niche that was not filled before. We asked for this bill earlier with a lot more money in it because I think the market is out there, but we were very satisfied with the treatment that we got from the Appropriations Committee, and I stand for any questions on the bill.
The question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 153 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 153 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Joint Resolution 10. The clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution Number 10, introduced by Representative Dirks, a joint resolution requesting Congress to support the Local Radio Freedom Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blake, Brechtel, Dirks, Edmonds, Samuelson, Semlich, Teeters, Wallace, Wanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Samuelson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Samuelson?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution Number 10 do pass. And I will defer to the sponsor of the bill.
Representative Dirks.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Joint Resolution 10, radio stations. This is the one that asks Congress not to pass the bill that would impose a performance fee on local radio stations for playing each song. It is important to our radio stations that operate on the slimmest of margins. And many of them say that if Congress were to pass this, they might have to either shut down their operations or go to talk show format. So I would encourage your support.
Any further discussion on House Joint Resolution 10? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Samuelson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Joint Resolution 10 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Joint Resolution 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for your consideration is House Bill 137. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 137, introduced by Representative Korberg, an act relating to crimes and offenses, the Castle Doctrine. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Begbie, Dockstetter, Gingrey, Olson, Shepperson, Throne. No, Alden, Buchanan, Mercer. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Buchanan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 137 do pass, and would further move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 137, and will briefly explain that amendment. Of course, on page 1, lines 1 through 9, we have just a few corrections to the introduction to the bill that reflect the changes made in the rest of the bill. If you look at page 2, in paragraph A, starting on line 4, the amendment basically takes out the immunity from criminal prosecution and goes ahead and defines the term criminal prosecution down there. We took that out as well on lines 12, 13, and 14. And because of the immunity issue that we just took out in subparagraph A, subsections B and C, which continue on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3, were taken out as well. Line 22 on page 3, the word person was deleted and the word intruder was inserted. On page 4, line 1, occupied structure was changed to another's home or habitation. At the end of line 2 on page 4 there, and on line 3, we changed it from the occupied structure to his home or habitation. Line 7, page 4, we deleted the words or had occurred. And then on line 22, we inserted the word or after the word used because we still had one subsection left on line 5 on page 5. We renumbered that Romanet 3 from 4 because we got rid of Romanet 3 right above there, as you can see. And on line 7, page 5, we deleted an occupied structure and again inserted another's home or habitation. Lines 13 through 20 on page 5, this is a rather important part. We deleted subsection C there altogether. This was a section that had basically changed the current status of the law when one was outside of their home. And it had said that whoever is attacked in any other place where you've got a right to be has no duty to retreat and can stand their ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if they believe it's reasonably necessary to prevent death or serious bodily injury to themselves or another. That's a major change, and that was deleted with this amendment. Then we renumbered subsection D to be subsection C. On line 23, we changed a person's occupied structure to another's home or habitation, and that's pretty much the end of the Standing Committee amendment.
Representative Korber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would like to divide the amendment. I would like Division 1 to be lines 1 through line 45 on page 1, and on page 2 of the amendment, line 5, 6, and 7, that would be Division 1. Mr. Chairman, and Division 2 then would be on page 2, lines 1 through 4.
Okay, finding that it is divisible, Division 1 would be, just to confirm, line 1 through 45, page 1, and lines 5 through 7, page 2, and Division 2 would be line 1 through line 4, page 2, correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In respect to Division 1, I have no particular concerns or problems with Division 1. I think some of the changes that were made were very helpful. And if there are no questions, I would call for the question on Division 1.
Any further discussion on Division 1? The question having been called on House on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Division 1 to House Bill 137. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Division 1 has passed Committee of the Whole. We're on to Division 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the good Chairman of Judiciary explained to you, Division 2 is a very, in my opinion, is a very important part of this bill. It is definitely a policy decision that this body has to make, as well as if this bill is passes on third reading, the body down the hall will have to make. I guess I can't ever remember a time in American history when
we were put in the position or thought that we were put in the position where we had to run. That if we were attacked, that we had to run, that we had a duty to retreat, that we could not defend ourselves. And I think Section C on page 5, if you will just look at it with me, I think the section is very well written. I think it is fact-driven and it's fact-specific. And it simply says that if you as an individual are in, if you are attacked in a place where you have a lawful right to be, just right out here on the street, walking right down the Capitol, you have no duty to retreat. That if you choose, all this does, it doesn't say you have to, it just gives you the option to stand your ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if you reasonably believe that it is necessary to prevent death or serious bodily injury to yourself or to your fellow colleague that happens to be walking right down those stairs beside you. That is the essence of this section. And I think it speaks to the very heart about what this country stands for. I cannot imagine putting a young mother who's with her two children in the position of having to make the decision as to whether she scoops those children up and retreats or whether she insists that those children retreat and she fights to protect the lives of those children. And that's what this policy decision is basically all about. It puts in statute, it very clearly states that it gives you the option to do this if you so choose. And there are, I think, things that are in the bill that protect it, that you have to reasonably believe that you're in serious danger of losing your life. It's fact-driven, it's specific. And I think it deserves our consideration and it deserves our passage. So I ask for support of Division 2 of the amendment.
Representative Olson.
I stand in opposition of Division 2 of the amendment. We heard a lot of testimony in this, and we actually heard quite a bit of testimony on this. And right now, the way the law is, let me just be real blunt about it. You know, defend your home, defend your property. Castle doctrine is what it says. Defend your castle. And I like that idea, and I think you should be able to. I'm not so... I'll give you an example that was used in committee. Let's say I'm driving down the street. Some guy cuts me off. I get really... And that would have been the aggressor. Okay? I get really, really mad. I follow this guy down to the nearest gas station, block him in, jump out of my car, and run over to him, and now I assault him. Okay? Should I have retreated when he did it, or should he retreat when I do it? Or does he have a right now to come back at me? And so we have to look at that, and that's kind of crazy there. We don't need that to happen. And quite frankly, you know, defend yourself as you can, as you should. But doggone it, you know, we don't want you to be let's not play cop out there. Let's not go back to the old days to where you settle things. If this comes back in, what that's going to do is, okay, let's just take it out in the alley and have a little gunfight. Well, let's do things like that. And that's not good policy. That's not good for us. Let's not give people the opportunity to be violent. If you have a right to defend yourself, and I think that's great. But, you know, let's let law enforcement do what law enforcement is supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with walking away sometimes if you have the opportunity to. That's the right thing to do when you can. On and for the amendment. Thank you, the way you guys were looking at me.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Except for the last part on line 19,
where it says, or to prevent the commission of a violent felony. Do you know that whether you have that right now?
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, obviously, I am not an attorney, so I don't know. Part of what this whole bill is about is I really don't know what I have the right to do and not to do according to state statute, because there is nothing in state statute that addresses this. Everything in Wyoming is based on common law and case law. We all know that case law happens after the fact, so it's based on instances where you've already made the choice. So I guess from my standpoint, I would accept the consequences right now, and if I saw my fellow colleague, you know, being horribly physically harmed on a street corner, I would interfere to prevent the commission of a violent felony. And I guess that, too, is a policy decision you make here today. We can put into statute whatever we want. We make the laws in this body. And then after the law is made, that will set case law, and it will take precedent over common law. So it's up to the will of this body. If they want to go ahead and defeat this amendment, and I think I said it incorrectly when I first spoke, because by defeating the amendment, you're allowing this to stay in the bill the way it's written, and bring back a second reading amendment to take that last part out. You know, it's this. You're crafting a very important part of state statute right now by this very discussion. So the amendment would take it out, and I stand opposed to the amendment to take that entire section out. And I'm not sure if I've answered your question or not. But
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to respond to a couple things. First of all, if C stays in the bill, if you oppose the amendment, law enforcement doesn't like it, county prosecutors don't like it, because it encourages violence in the streets. If that's the policy call that we want to make, we can talk about encouraging violence in the streets. That's what C does. C does not limit removing C does not limit anyone's right to self-defense and to protect themselves or their children when necessary. And I would say to you that a parent, mother's first responsibility is to protect her children. And if she deems that the best way to protect her children is to retreat, then I think that's certainly something we want to encourage her to do. If she deems that her best way to protect her children is to go after the guys in the street, then I think no jury in this state and no prosecutor in this state is going to go after her for anything. I think we're pretty safe in saying that's the current law of the state of Wyoming, with or without C. If we leave C in the bill, you are encouraging violence in the streets. So keep that in mind. And while I supported this bill in committee without C, I can tell you that I certainly will not support this bill with C in it. Thank you.
Representative Yeagy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure I agree with everything that was just said. I have talked to some law enforcement that are okay with the ability to protect yourself as written here. And I just think outside your home, we're talking about in the streets, in a mall, wherever you might want to be, you have the right to protect yourself and others. If you fear that you have bodily harm to yourself or others, such as being robbed, beaten, you see somebody being raped, I think you have the right, just about, you know, the right to help and maybe even a little bit of responsibility. These people that we see in the papers every once in a while are recognized as our everyday heroes, the Good Samaritans, that are stepping in to stop, and I think stop some violence from taking place. And I don't think I agree that this is going to create violence. I think in Wyoming we are common sense folks, and it is just meant to make us safer and help one another. So I just think C is just very important to the Castle Doctrine. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I couldn't agree more with some of your statements that were just made. Being a good Samaritan, I think you have to be. I think it's your duty to be a good Samaritan. If we use the example that the last speaker used. But right now, and he was right in a couple of things he said, but he was right because it is the state of the law right now. And let me read a couple of things to you. On duty to retreat, the defendant was justified in using deadly force to repel the danger only if he retreated as far as he safely could before using deadly force. That can be done right now. Let's say somebody assaults you and you stand to fight. You can defend yourself, and it says self-defense need not retreat or consider whether he can safely retreat so long as he does not use deadly force. So it's there right now. We have it. So I think that's real, real important. On for the amendment and actually on for the bill.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the division number two, but for the bill. Just a question to the bringer of the bill. Since there's been some questions raised, in particularly to line 19 and 20 on page 5, at the end of C, whether or not we're expanding this beyond what the current law is, and what I'm drawing to is the clause, or to prevent the commission of a violent felony. I think most people are in agreement to the beginning part, to prevent death or serious bodily injury to himself or another. It's that last clause, or to prevent the commission of a violent felony, that there may be some judgment issues there as to what the person considered a violent felony. Would the bringer of the bill consider, because we sort of can't do it here with this, perhaps a second amendment, second reading amendment, if C comes back in to take out that last clause, would that be a consideration?
Representative Korber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Clearly, I would prefer that it stay in, but if I have to make a choice, you know, between having that taken out and leaving the rest of C in, I would obviously prefer to have the rest of C in. So if someone would care to bring that amendment as a second reading amendment, I would not speak against it.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I want to rise in support of Division 2 and just say that I think it's fairly reasonable. I know we have this already in case law, as I believe the next speaker is going to bring up. But I don't see the harm in going ahead and putting it in the statutes. And I think it's, for all of us, it's reasonable. If someone comes at you in whatever public place, be it an alley, a street, your response is going to be to defend yourself. You're not going to run away from it, generally speaking. And I don't think the idea that all of a sudden we're all going to be packing pistols and shooting each other in the street seems rather ridiculous. That's not going to happen. And then to address one other issue about letting our law enforcement do what they need to do, I think you could probably ask any law enforcement officer who would tell you that they very seldom arrive in the middle of a crime. They very seldom stop a crime from happening, but normally arrive after it's already done. And this is simply giving people the right to be able to defend themselves before the law enforcement arrive. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important that this bill is not a departure from the law in the state of Wyoming as it's existed for the last 108 years. The law in the state of Wyoming, as stated by the Wyoming Supreme Court, says, we think it is better that it should be clearly stated and understood that one who starts out upon an expedition which involves a felonious assault upon another in his own house takes his life in his hands, and the right to take it from him depends only upon the apparent necessity which he himself may create. The person so assaulted has the right to defend himself and to pursue his adversary until he has freed himself of all danger. Those are the rights you have now. If this bill doesn't expand them, the bill's going to act as a limitation of rights. The Wyoming Supreme Court further interpreted that case in 1981 when they said that a person would be justified in using deadly force even though the appearance of danger later proved to be false and there was actually neither purpose on the part of the other person to kill him or to do serious bodily injury or harm or imminent danger that it not be done, nor actual necessity that deadly force would be used in self-defense. If the person so confronted acts in self-defense upon such appearances of danger from honest belief, the right of self-defense is the same whether the danger is real or merely apparent. If this bill contracts those rights, then I would oppose it. If these amendments contract those rights, then I would oppose it. I don't think that the bill says anything better than what the law already exists. I understand the need to codify it. I think the bill with the amendments that grants the immunity provisions are fine, but on and for the amendment.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the Speaker Pro Tem just made the point. It took one of the leading attorneys in this state the last 5 minutes to explain to us what the case law is. Most folks in the state are not as gifted as the person who just spoke and understand the case law. That is the reason why we're taking the case law and codifying it into statute. So then the normal prudent man or woman will have clear understanding of what the law is. And I would also make the second point, because I think there's been some confusion. A few people stood up and said they support Division II, and then they talk, and it's obvious they oppose Division II. A yes vote removes C out. A no vote leaves C in. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, by no means am I an attorney, and I understand most of the debate here, or at least I think I do. Concerning this amendment in particular, I won't mention what city it happened, nor will I mention what district attorney was involved happened. But I was approached, in fact, many of us were approached, either last year or the year before, with emails concerning a lady that her daughter and the daughter's fiancé were attacked by the ex-husband, and the police made the determination that the daughter and the fiancé were in the wrong in preventing the ex-husband from doing some things. And I think it was on the daughter's property or the mother's property. Again, I've been sitting here at the computer seeing if I can find that correspondence on the emails. But if my memory serves me, page 5, lines 13 through 20, codifies what the law said was right in the first place, and the police weren't handling it right, nor was the courts actually supporting the people that were doing what were basically in the court cases, allowing them to do this. So I would say on and against the amendment and for the bill.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Be careful what you wish for. Listen to this little set of facts. This actually happened in the south part of this city, and this is a 1983 Wyoming Supreme Court case. And if I slip and put a name in there, I'll call my bad. The appellant participated fully in the prior quarreling and conflict with the decedent. When he went into the kitchen, now this is in a house, but it's not his house, okay? It's not his place. When he went into the kitchen to obtain the knife, he had the option of walking out the door and going peacefully to his own home. There is nothing to indicate that his life was in imminent jeopardy at that time except his claim that it was. Instead, he chose to take a knife from a kitchen drawer, return to the living room, and fatally stab the decedent. While the appellant may want to believe that those circumstances constitute self-defense, the law should not justify him in this aberrant style of thinking. Now, the jury instruction that the defense asked for is almost verbatim this statute. And the defense said, here's what they wanted to tell the jury. The defendant had a right to go where he will. If he had reasonable grounds to believe and actually did believe he was in imminent danger or serious bodily harm, and that deadly force was necessary to repel such danger, he was not required to retreat from a place where he was legally entitled to be. He was entitled to stand his ground and use such force as was reasonably necessary under the circumstances to save his life or protect himself from serious bodily harm. Under that jury instruction, he would have walked. And the district court said, no, we aren't going to do that. The district court said, here's the instruction that was given. Even if the defendant had reasonable ground to believe and actually did believe he was in imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm, he was justified in using deadly force to repel the danger only if he retreated as far as he safely could before doing so. The law requires a person to retreat rather than take the life of his adversary if there was a convenient mode of retreat without increasing his peril. To excuse a failure to retreat, it is necessary that the defendant's peril would be increased, or that it reasonably appeared that it would be increased by retreat. If you find the defendant could not have safely retreated, but could have safely retreated but failed to do so, the defendant cannot rely on the justification of self-defense. Now, that is a big problem, as I say, and our judges have written eloquently on this topic since the time of English law. And then the court went on, and I just want to read, I don't want to read a whole bunch of this to you, but listen to this. Self-defense will justify a homicide when a reasonable person deems it necessary in order to avoid infliction of death or great bodily harm upon himself. To justify a homicide on this ground, it must appear the defendant was in great peril of death or serious bodily harm, or had reasonable grounds for believing so. It must appear that the killing was a necessary and reasonable means of avoiding the threatened harm, and the facts and circumstances surrounding the event must be such as to afford such grounds for that belief. Now remember these facts. He participated fully in the prior quarrel and conflict with the decedent. When he went into the kitchen to obtain the knife, he had the option of walking on out the door and going peacefully to his own home. There's nothing to indicate his life was in imminent jeopardy at that time, except his claim that it was. Instead, he chose to take a knife from the kitchen drawer, return to the living room, and fatally stab the decedent. Now ask yourself, under that set of circumstances, whether you like this or not. I urge you to vote in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment and get rid of this nonsense.
Representative Korber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's get rid of this nonsense. Go look at Section C on page 5. Let's just take a minute and let's read it out loud. If you are not engaged in an unlawful activity and you are attacked in any other place where you have a right to be, you have no duty to retreat. Now, the instance that was just brought forward by my good colleague from Albany County is not even remotely close to what this section is telling you here right now. That example that he brought forward, the gentleman in question, was not attacked. Totally different set of circumstances than what we're talking about in this section here today. This is precisely why we need to clarify in statute what we are talking about in terms of our own rights. We've had how many of our colleagues today who are in the legal profession come up and tell us that this is all in case law, all there, it's common law, but we have no idea what it says. As an individual, we do not know. Now, the example that was just brought forward, it doesn't ring true for this instance. It is not true. So be careful what you wish for, yes. This is not nonsense. Many of our colleagues have stood up here today and said, well, our judges have written eloquently. Well, I'm here today to tell you that it's time for this body to stand our ground and to legislate eloquently for our right to self-defense. And I urge you to defeat Division 2 and leave Section C in. Thank you.
Representative White.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question. As a member in law enforcement, you have to wonder about definitions in some of these, in some of this wording. In paragraph C, it says who is attacked. I would like some kind of a definition of attacked. If we have to investigate these types of situations, we have to understand what attacked it is. Is that verbally? Is that assault? I'm just not real clear on that, on and for the amendment.
Right. The question being called for, and this is on...
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, Chairman McComey.
Just one quick thing. We've all heard all the opinions, the court opinions and everything else. Just think about this for a second. When something like this is happening, do you have the mental capacity to dig back into all of these things that you've just heard? The average citizen doesn't. I couldn't process all of that to make up my mind whether I should run, what I should do. I think this is saying to the people, you have the right to defend yourself. And that's on and against the amendment.
All right, are we ready for the question? The question being called, and the question is called on Division 2 of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 137, Division 2 being lines 1 through 4 of page 2. And all those in favor of Division 2 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Division 2 has failed. Division being called for, all in favor of Division 2, please stand. Those opposed, please stand. Division 2 has failed. We are back on the bill. Okay, the question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with recommendation that House Bill 137 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 137 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. The motion is passed.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 133, recommended, do pass. House Bill 11, amended and further amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 12, recommended, do pass. House Bill 98, amended, recommended, do pass. House Bill 134, recommended, do pass. House Bill 53, recommended, do pass. House Bill 153, amended, recommended, do pass. House Joint Resolution Number 10, recommended, do pass. House Bill 137, amended, recommended, do pass. Signed, Representative Stubson, Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
All of those opposed signify by saying no. Congratulations, Representative Stubbs. Committee announcements. Chairman Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet immediately upon adjournment in room, committee room H-17 to discuss House Bill 135, fuel disclosure, House Bill 136, dyed fuel enforcement, House Bill 130, establishment of public roads, and House Bill 142, driver services fees.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, correction from earlier announcement on the meeting. Your committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet Friday morning at 8 a.m., not 9 a.m., in room H-10 to consider the following bills. Senate File 2, Select Natural Resources Funding Committee, Chairmanship. Senate File 3, Game and Fish Funding.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to consider House File 49, Impact Assistance Payments. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet upon noon recess tomorrow to take up Senate File 61, School Finance Recapture Payments, Senate File 17, School Facilities Infrastructure Costs, and School Facilities Amendments, if time allows.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in room H-18 to hear Senate File 44, Residential Mortgage Practices Act, and Senate File 57, Hospitals, Participation in State Retirement.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 12, Rules and Procedures, will meet upon adjournment in B-63 to consider the following bills. House Bill 69, the Revisers Bill, House Joint Resolution 1, Initiative and Referendum Requirements, House Bill 42, Constituent Service Allowance, and House Bill 75, Legislative Per Diem.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, will meet tomorrow afternoon at noon to consider Senate File 39, State Miners Hospital Board.
Chairman Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow, Friday, February 22, 2008, at 8 a.m. in H-8 to consider Senate File 64, Valid Court Orders, and Senate File 32, Board of Parole Authorizing Changes and Length of Parole.
Further announcements. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, you have the general file list that was handed out to you. Our rules require third reading as the first item on the agenda, so we will go into third reading on the budget at 9. And I urge your restraint with the budget amendments. Realistically, if you are just bringing back the amendment that passed on second reading and have tweaked it a little bit, keep it short. From what we saw on second reading, your likelihood of getting it passed is quite remote. And keep that in mind. If it's not at all necessary for you to bring the amendment, we'd be happy to have you withdraw it. But certainly it is a budget session, and we are here to work the budget, and we will do that first tomorrow, and then we will wrap up with general file and try to get you out of here and on the road for those of you that are attempting to travel tomorrow at a reasonable time. And with that, Mr. Speaker, does the Speaker Pro Tem have something?
He does, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Correction on the announcement for rules and procedures. Meet immediately upon adjournment in the basement conference room, not B-63.
Mr. Majority Floor.
Mr. Speaker.
Oh, one more thing. Representative Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
I think there's been a lot of thanks given around here, and I think this job that's been done by our majority leader of getting these things sorted out so that we could pass them today, I think we got on track today and really covered a lot of work, but his organization certainly helped that.
Folks, one thing on this white general file list, the ones that are asterisked that have not come out of committee will not appear on the yellow sheet, but they will appear at the bottom possibly. And then once they are read in and before we start general file, you'll get a new list. With that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 9 a.m. on Friday, 8 a.m. on Friday, 9 a.m. on Friday, February 22nd, 2008.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed to the motion say no. We are adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, Friday the 22nd of February.